world gone insane. An upside-down civilization that cannot be real. A world of madness and terror.
It's the Dana Gould Hour.
Today's show is brought to you by Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. They do. Also, thanks to HelloFresh.com for supporting our podcast. The Dana Gould Hour has teamed up with HelloFresh, and they're offering everyone in our audience $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code DGH30. Today's show features two amazing guests: author, actor, podcaster, husband, father, and men's facial hair advocate, John Hodgman is here. Many people first became acquainted with John from his appearances on The Daily Show, but he is so, so much more than that. And he has an excellent new book out now called Vacation Land, and he is here to discuss it and so much more. Also, I was recently in the lovely city of Chicago, Illinois, where I was able to speak with one of my heroes, Rich Kohs himself, otherwise known as Sven Gulli. He of MeTV's Sci-Fi Saturday Night, an American institution, and as America's leading horror movie host, a man I am somewhat, if not very, jealous of. Speaking of me, which is a great title for a book, you may want to come and see me perform my live comedy all-professional joke-telling show in the near future. Well, come on down. December 14th, 15th, and 16th, I'll be in San Francisco at the Punchline. My good buddy Emma Arnold will be joining me for those shows. They're sure to sell out, so please get your tickets early, and then show up and get them oily. January 4th, 5th, and 6th, I'll be in my home away from home of Atlanta, Georgia, at the Laughing Skull, one of my favorite clubs and one of my favorite cities. How can you go wrong? February 2nd and 3rd, I will be in Arlington, Virginia at the Alamo Drafthouse and Cinema, so all my DC friends are encouraged to high on out. And February 22nd, 23rd, and 24th will find me in Denver, Colorado at the Comedy Works. For details on all of these and more, toddle on over to danagould.com, click on the See Me Live page or the calendar page or whatever it's called this month. You'll see it, danagould.com. Just go, please, please, please. And now, let's do our filthy business. It's a genuinely crisp morning here in Falcon's Lair Recording Studios, high atop the Hollywood Hills.
Autumnal.
It is autumnal, which for Los Angeles is saying a lot.
Right.
Autumnal for Los Angeles is dipping down into the 80s. And we're here to talk about a place that gets very autumnal. That
yes.
The definition of foliage.
Right.
And I'm joined by someone. It's criminal that you've yet to be on the show.
I know.
You're one of those
warrants for my arrest.
You're one
in
of
podcast, podcast. The sheriff of podcast town.
Podcastin.
Yeah.
But you are also I'm going to embarrass you. You're one of those people that in fact both of the guests this week are people that like, "Holy shit, I know him."
Oh, shucks.
He's a friend of mine.
Oh, shucks. And I know who the other guest is.
Yeah, I know.
And I know you. So
yeah,
I know what high esteem.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not messing around.
If I'm in the same pantheon
yeah.
as Son of Sven Gulli,
yeah,
now
like,
Sven Gulli.
It's not like Lenny Kaye or Patti Smith. It's right. like a real important person.
Thank you very much.
But I'm joined by a author.
Sure.
Actor.
Yes.
Gadfly.
Oh, yes.
Might we say, performer?
Sure. Yeah.
John Hodgman.
This is the sound of my voice.
And John is here for many reasons, but you have a book out.
I do.
Called Vacation Land.
That's right. Vacation Land is my new book. And Vacation Land is it's my new book of funny stories.
Ribald.
Not very ribald.
They're not very ribald.
Because ribald suggests a certain sexual
sauciness.
Saucy.
Maybe the femlin would be somewhere around it.
A certain flirtatious quality.
Coquettish.
This is more the story of the life of one weird only child from New England who feels uncomfortable.
Exactly.
In the countrysides of Western Massachusetts and Maine. And there's a long section, I mean, to give you a sense of just how unribbled it is. Where I describe,
which, by the way, that will be the opening line of my obituary.
I describe my growing up as a weird only child in Brookline, Massachusetts.
Mm-hmm. And where JFK grew up, I believe.
Yes, not in my house, but he might have. We had a very big house.
He could have been upstairs.
Yeah, we rented out a lot of
knocking around.
Yeah, we had a lot. We rented out the top floor. We rented out. There's a mother-in-law apartment in the house.
Oh, really?
It was a very big house. My mom and dad were the first in their families to go to college and put some money together, and they moved to Brookline, and they bought this big, rambling, falling-down house that my mom was dedicated to propping it back up again.
Right, right, right.
And so I was an only child, and we would just wander around this house. We had rooms we didn't know what to do
heaven.
With. We'd see each other like twice a week or whatever.
Yep.
And we had these boarders. And around the time I was 13.
Boarders?
Yeah. We had they were like colleagues of my mom. She worked
They knew him. It wasn't like the lodger. Hello.
No. No, they were long-term. They were students at Boston College or long-term interns at Beth Israel Hospital or whatever.
Bums, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And this woman left the mother-in-law apartment around the time I was 13. And while it was empty, I said to my mom and dad, "That's mine now."
And you had your own place at 13.
Yeah, this huge bedroom that I've never had to share with anyone in my life. Just too confining at this point.
Too confining. Yeah.
Yeah, I need my own apartment. I'm in high school, you guys.
Mm-hmm.
I need my own place. I've earned it.
Right.
And perhaps because they didn't hear me on the other side of the dining room when I muttered this, they didn't stop me. And so I stole this apartment. And the goal was very specific. It was because I was an only child and had never had siblings to kind of push me around or tell me that, like, that Doctor Who scarf looks dumb, don't go to school that way.
Or, I had those.
Yeah, right. I mean, most normal people did.
Well, those are two separate thoughts.
Okay, great. Yeah, good. We'll just put a full stop between them. And because I had no sports in me at all, like I never even had the rehearsal of conflict.
Right.
So all conflict felt fatal to me.
Yeah.
And that's any kind of high, emotionally intense interaction, whether it was fighting or hugging and kissing.
I get you.
So
I get you.
My goal when I was 13 was to completely leapfrog adolescence to become the 39-year-old sexless gentleman bachelor I felt destined to become.
Yeah.
And that's what I did in that apartment. I set up my books and my ferns.
You were a 13-year-old kid looking at Severn Darden going that.
Mm-hmm. It's like my hero was Edward Gorey, not merely because...
Speaking of people who have great rambling houses.
Yes, right.
In Centerville, I believe his house is.
In Cape Cod?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've never been by his house.
There's a book about his house.
About his house, yeah.
Yeah, and that house is about a mile from the house where my parents lived for like 2 decades.
Right.
In Centerville.
I need to go there because
it's fantastic.
A true hero of mine, not merely because... He's a great artist with an amazing sense of humor and a dark streak and everything else. But then I would see profiles of him and pictures of him in his house with, you know, books stacked on either side of him, wearing his huge beard and his fur coat and his sneakers, right?
Yeah.
And also had no sexual or emotional congress with anyone else in the world.
Right.
And I'm like, that's for me.
That's for me.
How do I get there?
He's a true New England weirdo.
Yeah, and one of the first. I mean, I later learned that, you know, he's been passed away for some time.
Yeah,
but the flavor of orientation that is called asexual.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the first people to say, "I got nothing. There's no."
I know You know, aside from Morrissey, which I don't know if he's still clinging to
this
that.
Is based on a biography I read of Edward Gorey, and if I got any element of this wrong, please.
Yeah, sure. I don't know.
Send me 1,000 emails.
Yeah, please attack me.
Looking forward to
please
it.
Please viciously attack me.
If I'm wrong, I like to know that I'm wrong. I'm one of the rare white dudes who feel that way.
All right. Well, I think it's about time that the internet was used for people hurling semi-informed insults at each other.
That's right. Thank you for your bad research.
Yeah, exactly. World War I, which ended in 1962. Yeah.
Thank you, John Roderick.
Yeah. No. I find it interesting in that you and I had similar sort of desires, although mine was far from sexless.
I eventually developed.
Yeah, I came around. Whereas I was nothing but conflict, I was.
Hang on, let me put it this way: I eventually developed a taste for pulsexuality.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
My wife occasionally shows me our children as proof.
Yes, exactly. See those?
Yeah. All right. Go.
But I do find it funny that my life was groaning with conflict, mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And just four older brothers and a younger sister. And I couldn't have been less fitted in my adolescent situation. But I had the same outfit. I just wanted to get away from any.
Sure.
Yeah. And I used to do a bit about this, that when I got married, I had to learn how to fight. Because I didn't realize that a fight meant we're having a disagreement, but I still love you, and mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. is something that we're going to resolve.
Right.
And to me, a fight was like, you know, I told you to get Morton salt and you get Ambrose salt. I'm moving out. Don't say.
Right. You learned it. You learned it in a different way because yeah. I've listened to the podcast. We've talked about mm-hmm. your life a lot. And so, you know, you were living in a condition of emotional intensity all the time.
I was living in a world gone insane, an upside down civilization that couldn't possibly be real.
So the conflicts that you were having, or you know, you were trained in conflict, but
yeah.
inappropriately.
Yeah, well, I was.
You were literally told the fact that you got the wrong salt. That's just going to destroy the family.
I would literally, for years at conflict, I would just possum out. I would go completely numb.
Yes,
I couldn't lift my arms.
Right,
you know, it
right.
was just.
Right, you wanted to, and yeah. so,
and now I'm all fight. Now I now I spoil. But what I loved about the book, the book as
have
described.
You, have you ever? Okay, go ahead.
No, the book as described. It's really two stories.
Yes,
it's your.
That's two for the price of one, everybody.
Exactly.
I mean, that's a pretty good deal.
It's your discomfort.
Amazon's selling it for $14.80 right now. So
really?
You
have,
yeah.
That's $7.40 a book.
That's right. $7.40 a book in hardcover. Yeah. Beautiful Aaron Draplin design cover. So come on, you guys. Go get it. But you were saying about me.
Yeah. Aaron, you know, you're throwing around Aaron Draplin, and then you're, on the other hand, you're saying you're not getting laid. Come on.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's what happened. When I, you know, if I were single, I would just go into a bar and say, "Ladies, do you like my field notes?"
And the next thing you know, Jen's a millionaire.
I have some limited edition field notes here. This is the Empire State version. That's where I'm from.
Thank you very much. That's all the time we have today. Couple things before we get going. Thank you for coming out. It's a cold rain. It's actually a perfect day, not only for a podcast, but for our guests. I'll explain. One, this is here in case anybody forgets where they are. The band is just talking. No, it's saying he's. I believe that should be a possessive S. On the studio lot where I used to work, I was in the writer's building, which did not have a possessive S on it, on the giant sign on the writer's building, which was grammatically incorrect. Be that as it may. And this club also has nice textured wallpaper, which you don't see a lot. This is actually a classy – this is the kind of wallpaper that you'd see in either a really cool house or in a place where you would go in to get a massage where you weren't really getting a massage. Which I once went to. I was in Monterey, California, which is, I should have known, it was right near a naval base. And I hurt my neck. And my neck hurt. And I went in to get to the specialist. Said, if it says, if the sign's in neon, that's a signal. And then you walk in, and if there's a small Venus de Milo anywhere, and which is ironic because if there's one thing the women who work there certainly have, it's hands. And I walked in and said, how much for a massage? And the woman said, it's $50 for a half an hour, and then you can buy extra time. And I literally went like, oh. And then I got very indignant. No, I'm hurt. But I was coming here. It was so great to be here in Rosemont. It's like, I'm going to Chicago. Where are you playing? In Rosemont. That's not Chicago. No, I know. I have a date with Jennifer Lawrence. Really? Well, Steve. But that's fine. But I really appreciate you guys coming out today, and we have a great show, so let's get right to it. John Ennis will not be here, but Political Talk with Two Guys from Boston, for those of you who like it, many hate it. But we're doing it again. John and I are doing – we're doing it. He's coming to my house next week. We just had a hard time making our schedules work. Some people love that. Many hate it. I don't know why. I don't know why. But joining me today is the very, very funny – you know, certain things you don't know exist. And one of them is a woman comedian. Black Republicans, women – they're real. She's a incredibly close friend of mine, and she's very funny. We work together a lot. And two things I did not want my podcast to be was a sausage party and just comedians talking about stand-up all day. I was just – that's the last thing I wanted. And I've been very, very lucky. I have a lot of great guests and a lot of great friends. And she is in the top three, not the top two. No, she's but she's one of my best friends. I'm so glad she's here. Please welcome Emma Arnold, ladies and gentlemen.
This is, I like it up here. It feels very murder mystery.
Clearly, one of you is a murderer. How are you, Emma?
I'm all right. I'm enjoying our hotel. It's a little murder mystery.
Our hotel's a bit of a murder mystery. I don't know if you know that, but we live in the meat freezer.
Yeah, we were at the hotel where they found a girl in the freezer, which when you they don't tell you when you come in. They're very...
Yeah. Corpses. Well, it says on the door, corpses, otter pops, ice. yeah, and I asked the room service guy who brought me some coffee this morning. I said, hey, stay out of that freezer. And he just looked at me and said, yeah, I think the rain's going to let up.
Yeah.
which is a great thing to do. You know, we have a friend, Kevin Fitzgerald, who used to be a bodyguard for the Rolling Stones. And was on the show, and he told us a story that when they would approach a guy that was trouble, they would ask them a non sequitur question to throw them off. And they would often go up to them and go, where'd you park? Where'd you park? And then while they were thinking, boop, they'd sap them.
Ever since he told us that, I've been so ready to use it in a situation.
Yeah. My brother Jim is a prison guard. You know. What do you tell your guidance counselor? I don't like anal rape per se, but I like to be around it. I see it as a part of the milieu of my career, if not the main drive. I'd like to referee. And he said that they'll often go like, is the TV on? Like they'll bring, hey, is the TV on? What? Oh, wow. Yeah. Hey, the ceiling. So, yeah, that's what this guy did. He threw out the it's going to stop raining. Okay.
I feel like maybe the woman who was leaving the show last night, maybe that's what she was doing to you. There was a woman who, as she was leaving, apropos of nothing, walked up to Dana in like the receiving line and said, what did she say? I don't want to get it wrong.
I was taking a photo with somebody after the show, and this woman came up. She'd had a couple. And she said, I don't have false idols. My only idol is Lord Jesus, but I'll take a photo with you. But is Jesus really going to be like, what was with the photo with the comic? And by the way, Jesus in my retelling is sort of a bro. But you know what? Jesus was a bro. He hung around with like 12 other dudes all the time. It was just like a bunch of, and by the way, you know, like baby duckling, do you know what a group of baby ducklings is called? A plump.
Oh.
Isn't that perfect? Plump. It's a plump of ducklings, a herd of cows, and a scroat of bros. Mm-hmm. A full scroat.
A full scroat.
Right. Yeah. And 13 is a scroat of bros. And that's what Jesus and the 12 apostles were, a full scroat of bros. But if you did like Jesus, what if you died and you went to heaven and Jesus was Jesus? It was exactly what you told it was. But it was like just kind of a dorky bro voice. Hey, guess who's dead? High five. No, really, really, you're totally dead, really. Why the comic picture? What's with all the taking my name in vain? What up? Not cool. Jesus also brutal self-defense.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to break a cinder block with my mind. That might have been one of those things that was only funny last night.
I guess so. Man, it was very funny to me.
Last night it was really funny. And then today it's just deader than Hefner, as we call it. Mm-hmm. You know, when people say, when you die, people go, he's in a better place. I don't know if Hugh Hefner's in a better place. Being the judge of a lifelong blowjob contest is a pretty good gig. What does heaven have to offer Hugh Hefner? So where do I just go to get to blowjob? That's not how this works, Mr. Hefner. This is heaven. We have a harp lesson over here, and this is really boring. I want to play pinball with Jimmy Kahn. Sorry, he's still alive. This is bullshit. I'm sorry, Mr. Hefner. We'll try to find someone to blow you. We'll need 10 minutes. Anyway, speaking of a dead guy getting a blowjob, I try to imagine Hugh Hefner dead and having sex for the last time, and it's sort of the same vision. I imagine his girlfriend, she's like almost 17.
Oh, God.
He's dead, and she's trying to put it beyond her. Mm-hmm. So she's just watching television, but it's Halloween, so it's just everything is just like The Mummy, The Walking Dead. And she's like, he's everywhere I look. Well, that does lead us into our guest. As I said, today is a cold, rainy Saturday. And if anything I remember from childhood on a cold, rainy Saturday, it would be to stay inside and watch crappy, and by crappy, I mean great horror movies. And the best part about watching horror movies when I was a kid, and where I grew up in Massachusetts, we had Creature Double Feature. Creature Double Feature didn't really have a host, but people that host those things, that's the only job I've ever felt qualified to do. And when MeTV came and I realized that Svengoolie was on it and it was still going on, I was so happy. And it's quite literally one of the only shows I watch every week. I love it. And the fact that I have since come to know him is one of those weird like show business things like, I'm fucking friends with Svengoolie. Don't get me in. I need fucking bullshit from you. I'm so grateful he's here, and I can't wait to interview him. So please welcome Chicago's own Rich Svengoolie Coles, ladies and gentlemen. Get right on that bad boy.
Somebody in the green room just asked me where I was parked. Does that mean anything?
I think you're fine. For the benefit of those listening at home, you're out of makeup. You're just appearing here. And I kind of feel like Eddie Munster when he met Louis Nye out of Zombo makeup.
See, Eddie, I'm just a regular guy. I once worked with Louis Nye. I did a radio commercial with him. He was doing Admiral TV commercials. And he was Admiral. It was a whole shipboard thing.
Right.
And I was like one of the, sailors. And I used that voice like that.
What I remember about, do you know what we're talking about? The Zombo, famous episode of the Munsters. By the way, my easy recall of specific Munsters references is the reason my life is an avalanche of pussy.
Yeah. Yeah.
As I've said it before, and I've said it again, my list of things that I like is the leading cause of vaginal dryness. Eddie Munster met Zombo, but Zombo was really scary looking.
And Eddie was sitting there, you know, and his friends were saying how Zombo was the coolest. And if you watch when that scene happens, You'll notice that Eddie is mouthing the same words. He must have known all the lines for all the actors.
Oh, that's
funny. So when
funny.
His kind of overweight pal is going, Zombo is the coolest. You see Eddie going, I was just moving my lips for those of you at home.
There was there's a scene in Stand Against Evil, my little show on IFC that I also write. Thank you. Yes. Where we had to change takes because I'm doing that. Like, I'm mouthing because I wrote it. And I'm like, I'm doing my line, and then I'm watching John McGinley, and I'm mouthing his line, and then I mouth Janet Varney's line. And I go, why do we change the take? And they go, look at you. And I'm like, oh, God, I suck. I suck so hard. You talk about your discomfort in assumed comfort.
It's yes.
Like people go, like, oh, you have a house in the woods, whether it's the home that you, for lack of a better term, inherited.
Yes.
It talks about your discomfort in a house in Western Massachusetts that you more or less inherited.
Yeah.
And that, I know for me, that's a daydream. Like, oh, if I had a house out in the country, like way out in the middle of nowhere.
Sure.
It'd be so great.
That's the solitude that you've been craving since you were a child.
Right. Yeah. But I do know, and having tried it.
By the way, it's empty most of the time if you'd like to rent it.
Well, I have a similar.
Rent it? I'm your friend. What am I doing?
We have that here halfway up California coast.
Yeah.
There's a remnant of my cushy life when I was married to Madeline Moneybags. I say that fully knowing she listens.
Yeah.
Hello. You know Madeline. Nice. Yeah, you know Madeline.
Nice to see you, Madeline.
Yeah.
Yes.
Madeline's a good,
I love you.
Madeline's a good egg. You know, when I go up there, but it's, if you've ever read the Jack Kerouac book, Big Sur.
I've never read a word of Jack Kerouac. Can you believe
it? You're not missing a ton.
Mm-hmm.
But
I hear you wrote a lot of them.
If you like punctuation,
yeah, okay,
don't go there.
Oh, I am a fan, so yeah. All right, never mind.
But he has one book called Big Sur where he's gonna be a smoke watcher.
Mm-hmm.
He's gonna just go out in the woods by himself and achieve this sort of bodhisattva solitude and transcendence, and just being alone in the woods and looking for fires. And he quickly goes insane.
Sure.
And ends up like running naked, screaming through the woods of Monterey and Carmel, which is exactly what happens.
Yeah, right.
You know, you go up there and you're alone and you go out of your goddamn mind.
Well, even, you know, in the tradition of citified Massachusettsians.
Wow.
Kerouac being one
By
of them.
By the way, the citified Massachusettsians are opening for the Decemberists.
That's a great indie rock band name. Mm-hmm. You're right. Well, Kerouac was from Lowell, which is an industrial city.
I mean,
it's not exactly Brookline, Massachusetts.
No, right? It's a working class. Ham and Eggers.
Right. But in the tradition of the citified Massachusettsians going into the woods, there is not just me and Kerouac, but there is also one dude named Henry David Thoreau.
Exactly.
Which is, I was in Maine, over the summer, it was his 100th birthday or something.
Oh, really?
And on NPR, they were like, today is the, would have been the, no, the hun, the, not the 100th, obviously, 200th,
right.
500th, I don't know.
He was old.
He was old.
Is it, he passed away though, right?
Yeah, just last year. It was a rough 2016, weird, right? But here's the thing. NPR goes, this is the Xth anniversary of something to do with Walden by Henry David Thoreau. And then there's this pause as brains, as public radio nerd brains were blowing all over the country. And they said, yes, that's how it's pronounced.
Oh, that's funny.
According to the family.
Well, that's like when Chris Matthews goes out of his way to pronounce Dick Cheney, Cheney. You know, Cheney's saying this, and that's his real name. It's Cheney. It's how it's pronounced. It's Cheney. Cheney. People say Cheney. It's Cheney. And people do that. Like, butter. Well, everyone says butter, right? But you have or margarine. Whatever you want on toast. It's a good breakfast.
I'm waiting for the alternate pronunciation of butter.
Yeah, no, but he'll just go, and then he'll just run up.
He's so happy that he knows that thing.
Someone told me that there is footage of him like going down a line at one of the debates, going, who are you voting for? Why are you here? Who are you voting for? Why are you here?
Yeah.
And then he gets money. Why do you smell like that?
It was a university.
What was the smell?
It was patchouli. But he never, right. Never, I don't understand what that
is. I love that he thinks his job is to say the same thing over and over again and barely move his arm to get the microphone in the way. It's like, if that's what you think your job is, try to say it. Try to make a space between the words.
it's like when Letterman used to send Larry Bud Melman out to interview people, yeah, and he wouldn't understand that you have to hold the mic to them when they talk.
Oh. But Thoreau went into the woods,
right? Thoreau
for solitude.
Yes,
in solitude.
Go ahead.
Right. And had that little cabin, and he played his little recorder, and he thought his thoughts.
Right.
But people don't understand that he was a 5-minute walk away from Emerson's house, and he would go daily.
Yeah,
and get food and pies.
Yeah, it was cushier than one thing.
Yeah, so you didn't write that in your book, did you? You know what that is? That's white privilege right there. You don't even acknowledge you get free pies.
Free pies.
Institutional advantages.
Now, how do you eat a pie a day and not get just huge? But maybe he didn't care.
No, it all went straight to the neck beard.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those fashions that we don't miss.
No, look, people of podcasting listening range.
Yeah.
You cannot see my beard that I have right now. Now that I've not been on television for a little while, I wanted to see what would happen if I stopped taking care of myself. Come out of my face. And most of my beard is neck beard, and I'm so grateful for that neck beard.
That's
very kind of you.
Yeah.
I
was bearded until just recently.
You would never want to kiss me, so you can afford to say that.
That has nothing to do with your beard.
Yeah, no. It's.
But that is why, it's funny.
But this neck beard covers up neck meat that has been a source of embarrassment for my life. Suddenly I've got a jawline.
I had that as well. Yeah. I found that when I had a beard, I was like, oh, I look better.
Right.
And then and my kids hated my beard.
Sure.
Because
all rightful thinking humans who might be near you hate your beard.
Yeah. But I liked it. I thought it looked cool. And then I met an adult human woman.
Right.
And the beard had to go away.
Right.
And then I lost about 15 pounds and discovered my jawline.
You look fantastic, by the
way. Thank you.
Well done.
And for those of you who don't know, I'm wearing a Speedo and I'm fully oiled.
That's right. It was an interesting look when I walked in.
All I did was cut out everything.
Right.
Because I'm old. I get about 10 years on you. So much of your book is about, and I love the description, and I'm not going to do it justice. You're in your 40s. You're done procreating. What?
Yes. I open the book apologizing for my beard, and I say that it's a signal to the rest of the mating world.
Yeah, I'm done.
I'm all done.
I'm all done.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I've fulfilled my evolutionary purpose. My DNA is out there. I have children. I no longer deserve physical affection. You no longer need to get near this. It's time for me to focus on my weird dad hobbies.
It's really interesting that you say that because I never even thought of this. But during the summer, when I was working on the show in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Stand
Against Evil.
Yeah. Oh, I'll get those plugs in. Don't you worry.
I'm looking at a really handsome lunchbox with McGinley right on there.
You can take one with you.
Thank you very much. And I have to check a bag. Great.
I can mail it to you. That's why all those boxes are.
Oh, nice.
But I had been, I was not in a relationship, and I did think like, okay, I'm done.
Yeah,
I'm done. I've never gone on a dating site ever.
Wow.
And I kind of felt like, yeah, I had a good run.
I'm on 5 dating sites and I've been married for 18 years. No, I'm not on any dating sites.
Yeah, I saw Tinder on someone's phone and it horrified me.
I'm not on any dating sites. You're welcome, ladies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry.
I'm trying to think of another actor other than Severn Darden who would play you in the movie. you're on Lawton. It's for women who like the Charles Lawton type.
Yes.
Yes. Hello. Well, do you know Severn Darden?
No, I don't even know. I'm just laughing along Darden, like I know a thing because I'm supposed to know things.
Severn Darden was a Second City actor who always played in the 70s, the bearded intellectual. He plays the evil Henry Kissinger in Conquest of the Planet of the Apes. He played like a psychic on The Odd Couple.
Now, this is so deeply in your wheelhouse.
No, but you know.
But I. But it's not. Of course.
Yeah, yes, you've seen Seven. Yeah. And he had that.
But it's not. It's not so far outside of my wheelhouse that I shouldn't be embarrassed.
He's a big
that I don't
second,
know who this guy
he's a big
is.
Second yeah, city actor.
I totally recognize him now.
And
I
he
apologize.
Had that very banal yeah. sort of talking, but yeah. saying the terrible. What we're going to do is give you this injection,
right?
And it will make you tell the truth, and then you'll die very painfully. You
know? You know, it was just always a, and he's got a pretty sweet neck beard going.
He's got,
in there
oh,
too.
He's got a sweet, yeah. And right. he was back in the early 70s when the only shirts were turtlenecks.
That's right. Oh, what a time! What a
but
time.
Even there are photos of me in the early 70s wearing turtlenecks.
Sure,
I don't even. I don't like turtlenecks, but they were the only shirts you could buy.
Child, a school portrait of me, number one with a bullet, was mm-hmm. have to have been. I'm going to say fourth grade. Turtleneck, vertical striped. Mini stripes,
oh yeah,
multicolored, really high up turtleneck, Greek fisherman's cap. I was accessorizing you, at an early age.
Your fashion icon was John Lennon's dad.
I now sell that photo at conventions, claiming that it's a young George R. R. Martin.
I did a TV movie with Bruce Campbell. It was the Love Bug. It was the Disney TV movie remake of the Love Bug with me, Bruce Campbell, Mickey Dolenz, Clarence Hilton. No, Lawrence. Who was Link? Lawrence Williams the Third. Clarence Williams the Third. Right. I was just a C off. Lawrence Hilton Jacobs was Freddie Boom Boom Washington.
Boom Washington. Yes.
Again, C pussy, comma avalanche up. It was a TV movie for Disney, and it was shot by Peyton, directed by Peyton Reed, who has since gone on to direct the Ant-Man movies. And Bruce is the greatest guy on earth. And you used to know this joke about the hardest job in show business was the second unit director on the Munsters. It was like, it's really simple. It's just one shot. Marilyn's has a boyfriend over and Grandpa comes in. The boyfriend sees Grandpa, runs across the room, runs out the window, falls face first down a ladder, burrows a hole in the front yard, comes up under the sewer grate, and then runs down the street. It's easy. It's easy to do. It's one shot. They were doing a... They call it EPKs, which is an electronic press kit. And Clarence Williams III was being interviewed, and Bruce and I were just walking back from lunch or whatever. And we walked past Clarence, and he goes, this is Dana and Bruce, two of the actors in our company. And Bruce just went, wait, company? It's a talking car movie. and Clarence just like... And Bruce goes, shit, I pissed off Link. He also coined the phrase that I loved. I'm just a ham and egger.
Oh, a like, ham and egger.
Just a regular working guy. I don't know. He goes, I don't know. I'm just a ham and egger.
That was a big line with famous wrestling manager Bobby Heenan, who was a very funny guy, actually. And he just passed recently. But he used to refer to, the fans – you know, in a rather derogatory way. Oh, those ham and eggers.
Now, so you're also, in addition to being a horror movie expert, and you, Scott Alexander, Larry Karaszewski, Leonard Maltin, Cliff Nesteroff, Drew Friedman. I'm so blessed. I have all of these friends that we all, like, we can get on the phone and talk about Burt Mustin for an hour and a half.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
and you're one of these, but you also have these areas of expertise. You're really into wrestling.
Yes.
And you're really into the Stooges, which I want
yes,
to talk about.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. The Stooges, we did a show called Stoogeapalooza here, and every week. Oh, thank you. We'd run five.
Every man clapped and every woman looked quizzically around the room.
With disdain looking at us. Yeah. But we'd choose five different shorts and I'd find some sort of half-assed theme for them. And, you know, I'd give background.
Some slapping
on the
might
such.
Be one.
Parrots crawling into turkeys was a big one, too.
Light bulbs filling up with water was another one. Tom Kenny, who's the voice of SpongeBob, sure. Nothing makes him laugh harder than whenever a guy loses his clothes and has to wear a barrel with suspenders.
Have you ever seen a barrel with suspenders? That's my question.
And one of the, you know, it's so hard to get work in the 30s because of the Depression, but riveting suspenders into barrels was a big job.
Couldn't they make a belt?
You can make a nice cinch belt.
Yeah.
But you, now this is weird because you are very good friends with a very famous wrestler.
Oh, well, I wouldn't say we're very good friends.
Well, you're friends with the
rest of them. Yeah. Colt Cabana is a friend of mine, and he came and did my festival in Boise, and it was a huge hit.
I used to host these shows in L.A. called Lucha Vavoom.
Oh, which sure,
was,
yeah.
Mass Mexican luchador wrestling and burlesque dancers in between. Pasties, you know, no, nothing nude.
And that's just the wrestlers.
That's just the wrestlers. But the woman that I don't like girlfriend because she's not a girl. She's a woman. But woman friend sounds like somebody grandpa has to bring to dinner with him. You know, grandpa can't digest anything, so he's hooked up to that machine, but he's going to bring a woman friend for Thanksgiving. But she'll eat in the kitchen. We'll only call her. If you see any food stuck in the tube, call grandpa's woman friend. She used to wrestle. She wrestled with her sister. They had a twin act, I guess you'd call it.
Well.
Yeah, and it's really hard, even though it's all choreographed, you get the crap beat out of you.
Oh yeah, it's actually a very physical thing.
Yeah,
and you know, in fact, I saw Colt here at Zany's here in Rosemont. He was opening for Mick Foley, very famous wrestler, who, you know, has been in such bad shape most of his life now. He's had to have his hips replaced and such. He was the guy who was thrown off a, 20-foot-tall steel cage through a desk.
Ooh.
And they took close-ups of him, and he was smiling. There was, like, this little white thing there, and it was a tooth that had come out through a nasal cavity.
There's an interesting thing in the luchador culture. Because people think like the Hispanic culture, it's very macho.
Yeah.
It's very macho. But then they have these incredibly flamboyant gay wrestlers. And in Lucha Vavoom, we have this guy, Cassandro, who's, is a dude, looks like my aunt, has a bouffant haircut. And
did your aunt wrestle? Makeup.
He's a wrestler, but he's an animal. Oh, he sure, yeah. Walked along the parapet of the balcony, like fell down, like, and like literally he was like, I go, how you doing? He was like limping along before a match. And I'm like, how are you doing? He goes, I have a hernia. I have to get the surgery next week. But he was wrestling with a hernia. And like, and if you've ever had a hernia, just try to imagine all of your organs sneaking out through your balls. and they think you don't notice.
Oh.
Have you ever seen a water balloon just before it pops? That's what your nut sack feels like. And he was, and he wrestled with it, but it's also incredibly popular, which also leads to my other thing that I love. I'm glad it exists. I totally don't get it. Is the deep, deep love of Morrissey in Hispanic culture. I'm going to go see Morrissey in 2 weeks at the Hollywood Bowl, and I will be one of three white people there. And you'll see, like, really tough, huge, muscular, like, dudes with the Moz tattooed on their neck and pictures of Morrissey. Yeah. I don't know the origin of it. There's a documentary about it called Moz Angeles about just, like, they really, really love Morrissey. I don't get it. But it's also, it's nice. It's like, yes, he's in terms of, like, people like Cassandra, yes, he's gay. He's very flamboyant. And he'll kick your teeth down your throat.
You never want to mess with any of these guys because, everybody says, oh, well, they know how to fall and it's all fake. And it's like, well, you go tell him.
Break the news to him that he's not tough. Let's see how that goes. But all of those things, they're all of it, like wrestling and stand-up and sort of the horror movies. It's all the same. They're all wedges of the same pie.
And it seems like that was a typical day on most UHF stations at one time.
Yeah, and that was like before cable, like, and it was really Fox that harnessed all of these stations in 1986 when they formed their network. People forget in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you had the regular channels. You had ABC, NBC, and CBS.
Right.
And then you had UHF stations, which in Massachusetts, it was Channel 38, Channel 56, Channel 12 from Rhode Island. And now there's like, oh, I'm on the Chapstick channel. You're like, what? So the origin of Svengoolie was originally a guy named Jerry Bishop?
Jerry G. Bishop.
Not Joey Bishop.
No, no. He did never say son of a gun.
So, yeah. Was he ever funny, by the way, Joey Bishop?
I don't think so. I've seen the reruns of, like, his sitcom that had Joe Besser in it.
Yeah, sure.
And it's like, wow, when is this over?
Joey Bishop is one of those guys that you go, I guess that's sometimes you'll get this with comedians. They have all the ingredients of a joke, but it somehow doesn't become a joke. It's like if I gave you a bowl of flour with an egg in it and called it a cake. It's like, no, this is how you make a cake. The point that I was making was in the summer I had a beard and I was thinking like, I'm done. I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
It's fine. I had a good run.
Yeah.
I have many children.
Correct.
I'm done. And then literally I met someone and the beard went off. Like, I'm not done.
You're not done.
I still got
business.
As my ex-wife said, I said, like, yeah, I got to drop a couple pounds. She goes, yeah, you got to get camera ready.
You know, you articulated something just then that I realize is kind of what the book is all about. There are lots of moments in life when we feel that we are done or worry that we are done.
Right.
And this is a book about, to some degree, about middle age.
Yes, very much so.
It's the Western Massachusetts is the first part, which is a lot about when it's sort of in my 20s and 30s, really my 30s, before realizing that I'm going to get hit by this freight train after I turn 40, when I suddenly realized, oh, I'm not immortal. And for an only child to gut appreciate that they're not going to be the hero of the story of creation for time on and on forever.
Yeah.
It was offensive, frankly, to me.
It's
terrifying, right?
No, it's hard. My significant other has young children.
Yeah.
And I now think, okay, well, I'm 50, so I got 40 years. Yeah. And you're like, okay, I can get them. I can get them into college. I can take. And my dad turns 88 tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, well, as my dad would say, don't buy me any green bananas.
He's a business executive in the Boston area at a bunch of different kinds of companies. And the kinds of companies were different enough that I just got confused. Like, how can you be, you know, the CEO of this computer company and then run this venture capital, state-funded venture capital? Like, all of this was unknown to me. Like,
My dad was a bartender.
Well, I always forget his name because I just want to steal this line
for
myself.
Do what you love. Follow your bliss.
I always want to steal this line for myself, so I always forget who wrote it in the New York Times, but he said that he never understood on a basic level, he never understood any occupation that wasn't in a Richard Scarry book. And I was like, yes, that's exactly right. I know.
Wow. Yeah.
I know what a plumber does, and I know what I don't know what Lowly does. He seems to be just a layabout.
I would compare that too to like you, like some person would look at a bank and think, you know, what I could do is I could take a loan from that bank. I could get a bridge loan on my home, take a loan from that bank, microfinance 5 small businesses, amortize those profits into a shadow corporation that would allow me to not work and make a whole bunch of. And I look at that bank and go, I wonder if they would pay me to wash the doors of that bank.
Exactly so. It would be fun to be a guard there.
Yeah, I'd like to rake the leaves out of their gutters.
Yeah, it would be good in the summertime. You could just stand around in the air conditioning.
Yeah, to me, it's just a building that I have to clean.
I will say that my dad, when he retired, his last job for a long time was that he ran a state-funded investment firm that invested money in emerging technology companies in Massachusetts.
Wow. Which there are many.
That I am a parrot. When I say that, I have no idea what the words mean.
I know what he's doing.
I'm literally repeating something that I've memorized. It sounds like human speech, and now I'm going to go walk into a turkey.
He's driving.
References something off.
Yeah, we'll get it.
Before.
I'll tie it up.
All right, good.
He's driving up 128 a lot is what he's doing.
Yeah, and so, but he's
Barry
always been.
The great Barry Crimmon said the best joke
Yeah.
during the 80s when we were still in the Cold War.
And he goes, Route 128.
Cold War One.
Cold War One. Right. Nice. Yeah. He goes, Route 128, America's technology highway. Why don't you put an X on my head?
So my dad has always been sort of business and numbers inclined, mm-hmm. right? And he said to me a few years ago, I was visiting him, and he said, so I would like to create a schedule for visiting not me, but visiting your children, his grandchildren. I would like to have a schedule where I see them every 3 weeks or so, because he still lives in Brookline and we're down in Brooklyn, right. New York. And I'm like, sure, Dad, whatever you want. And he's like, because I've been doing the numbers and I realized that I think I have about 5 years when they will still want to be around me.
Wow. And, but I totally get it.
And it was, and like he had done the projections, the actuarial projections, right. similar to your dad. Like, this is how, similar to you, when you're like, this is how much time I probably have left for this important emotional relationship before they go get away. Mm-hmm. And I was like, you know, Dad, and we have a wonderful conversation, but there are very few times where I feel like I have to level with him.
Yeah.
And I'm like, Dad, that's depressing. And the fact is that you don't know how long your grandchildren are going to be like grandpa or whatever before they become teenagers and they say, get away, get thee behind me, Satan.
Yeah. We don't know. My oldest kids are at that now.
Yeah. We kids are different, but I'll tell you what, if they sense this coming off of you, this, I've only got 5 years, so I'm going to desperately hang on to you. You won't have 5 years. You'll have two.
Like, right.
That attitude is deadly.
It's self-defeating,
self-fulfilling prophecy of doom. But we do that kind of math all the time where it's like, am I done? Should I be done?
And that puts me to somebody with whom I am so fascinated. And we're straying from Vacation Land
Vacation Land available at Amazon for $14.80 mm-hmm. right now.
And I'll compare and contrast. What is beautiful about Vacation Land is, you know, we talk about Western Massachusetts, and being out in the woods and thorough, The thing I remember about
I tried
Western
to do the best job I could.
You did. You right
I tried
up there.
To be thorough. Get it?
Yeah. You did, weird dad.
Weird dad. Okay.
But I remember, you know, I went to college there. And the thing that I remember is foliage drives. People driving up through Western Massachusetts to look at the foliage.
Yeah.
And it is a very autumnal place.
Yes.
That is when that part of the country is in its glory in his fettle.
Absolutely.
And you and I are in a very autumnal place in our lives.
Yes.
You know, it's the Sinatra, you know, the autumn of my years. It's it's not winter yet. Your dad's in winter. My dad's in winter. But I had a therapist once, shocker, say something interesting. I was talking about, you know, That's my dog doing his famous Tony Randall on The Odd Couple impression. Felix, stop licking your nuts, Felix. That's Alfie, who has a look in his eyes that you would only see on a guy in an army jacket sitting on the swing set in the rain. He's got that, hey, man, what's it supposed to go on? What's it supposed to turn on like this, man?
But that's an amazing dog.
Yeah, he's a good boy. Yeah. He's a good guy.
Yeah. He's listening. He knows you're going to go somewhere personal right now. Yeah. And he's like, don't
do it. No one wants to hear this.
Get back on track.
But it is an autumnal tone, which I don't even I don't think it was intentional, but
the autumnal tone of
literally the physicality of where you are.
Oh yeah, right. Yeah,
and the emotional landscape.
Right, and autumn is, you know, it's a painful time because you are in the midst of enjoying this glory.
Yeah.
And also you get to wear a sweater and hide your disgusting body.
Exactly.
But you're fighting back the knowledge of what this portends. Yeah. Like, this beauty is announcing soon a bleak, cold
end. It's all downhill from here.
Yeah. And the fact that I discovered on a gut level, I mean, I was aware that I was going to die, but the fact that I discovered in that sort of terrified gut level moment of almost panic attack at the Montague Book Mill in Western Massachusetts in my 40s is testament to the luxury and privilege of my life, because there are lots of people in the world.
Middle age used to be 21.
Yeah, and there are lots of people in the world today who feel the reality of death and physical harm much more closely all the time from childhood. So that said.
Yeah, sure.
Privilege checked,
but you can only talk about yourself.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah. That moment, you know, is that moment where he's like, am I done? Should I be done? Mm-hmm. Should I just go away? You know, like,
right.
Why go forward? I know what's happening, and I know what's at the end of autumn now in a way that I didn't before.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of autumn to enjoy. If you're morbidly – and the second half of the book takes place in Maine, which is my wife's part of the world. She grew up in Atlanta, but her family is in Maine.
And Maine – for those of you who bowl,
yeah,
you'll get this analogy.
Yeah.
Maine is Western Massachusetts without the bumpers.
Right. Yeah, it's true. It's true. There are a lot of places where there are a lot of trenches, heartbreaking trenches.
Yeah.
Where your bowling ball, or to be more literal, your body can fall into and die.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And Maine, if you're of an autumnal mood, Maine is for you, because autumn begins on July 29th.
That's right. Yeah.
Like literally the leaves start turning.
Yeah.
It's in August. It's incredible.
Joey Bishop is one of those guys that you just sure. like. I guess it's funny.
Was it just guilt by association because he hung with
the big rat guys? Yeah, yeah. But like Don Rickles hung with those guys and he's hilarious.
Oh yeah, he was so funny.
But Don is one of those guys, and I've talked about this before, that you try to explain him to younger comics in woke culture, and it just it's a no sale. It's I'm like, no, but he doesn't. And I am like, I feel like Jack Webb talking to a hippie about like how great Bobby Troop is. You know, it's like they're just not buying it at all. Like, no, this is hip, man. I remember like Johnny Carson, maybe his last show, and he was talking about Doc Severinsen, and he was just like, and this is 92 or 3, or I guess 92. He goes, I mean, and you want to talk about hip? This band is hip. And you're like, no, it's not. But that's how I feel like talking about when Jerry Lewis died, God rest his soul. No one's ever said that, by the way. After Jerry died. Jerry Lewis dead. Uh-huh. You know the old joke about when Buddy Rich died, the musician calls up Buddy Rich, famous drummer, like one of the greatest drummers that ever lived, and a angry man. The famous story is one of his musicians calls up his wife in Palm Springs. He goes, is Buddy there? She goes, I'm sorry, Buddy died. He goes, oh, I'm sorry. He hangs up. Next day, calls back, is Buddy there? She goes, I'm sorry, Buddy died. And he hangs up. Next day, she calls up, is Buddy there? And he goes, why do you keep calling? He goes, I'm sorry, I just can't hear it enough. But I was watching the Jerry Lewis roast from 1968, and Don Rickles comes on, and his opening joke is like, Jerry, I say this from the bottom of my heart, Jerry, you're a Jew.
Oh, my God.
And people just go insane. And you can't explain that to, like, there's a certain generation of kids. Like,
sure.
No, I don't get it. And he made the most arcane anti-Italian joke I've ever heard, because Jerry Lewis's first wife was Italian, and he goes, whatever her name was, Cheryl, I don't know her name, was off the top of my head, but he goes, that Cheryl is great. An Italian woman with all her culture was out in the front yard this morning going, ice! It's a joke that goes back to the 1919s, like, when Italian immigrants would run ice wagons in the Bronx. It's like, that's the most obscure... And half the stuff he would say wouldn't even make sense. It was just a collection of words.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. Why don't you go home? He once said to Paul Schaefer on the Letterman, yeah, Paul's Canadian. Paul, why don't you go home, put some skates on your face? And you got to look. It's on YouTube. And Letterman just goes, what? And then it was great. For the rest of the show, he was just like, but he would just say, Don, I don't understand. Why? Why would Paul put skates on his face and then throughout the rest of the show? And Rickles was laughing because he was a great guy. And throughout the rest of the show, let him go to Paul Schaefer. Paul, I don't know, but maybe you should put some skates on your face. But Rickles and Jerry were the antithesis of each other, where Rickles was like, you know, would bust your chops, but then in real life was incredibly kind and incredibly sweet. And Jerry was like everybody's friend, and then in real life was a motherfucker. We were digressing. So you're in college. It's like 1970.
Yeah.
And are you in high school?
I just started at Northwestern University.
How old are you?
No, I'm kidding.
I'm 65.
You're just like, you're like a magic tree that can tell stories from a bygone era.
Come closer, children. I'll drop an apple on you, you little son of a... and I'd always been a fan of Jerry's. He was on radio for many years and then also worked at the TV station, which was right across the way from where the radio station was at the time.
It's 1970, but it's really the height of what we think of as the 60s.
Sure, yeah,
it's hippie, everything, you know.
Yeah, and he just happened to be the staff announcer who was on duty at WFLD here in town on Friday nights when they were running horror movies. And he just started, you know, goofing around doing the announcements back into the movie and such. And, you know, he started doing the accent, which he always called a cross between Bela Lugosi and his Jewish uncle. And these little announcements got larger and larger, and it was more shtick type stuff. And he included jokes that people were sending in. I was a fan. That was basically it. So I started sending him jokes and things like that. And so he started acknowledging me. And eventually this became so popular that they decided they would make him an actual character. The first stuff they did was shoot slides of him in the costume, just, you know, holding a tennis racket and things that made no sense.
Right.
And they just play him along with the voiceover to have nothing to do with whatever the shtick was that he had done. And eventually it graduated to being on video, the little breaks before and after the parts of the movie.
Now, was the hair a wig or was that his hair? Because it was 1970.
No, he did not have green hair. It was a long green wig because he was supposed to be a sort of hippie vampire.
Right. It was just, and I love how these characters that host horror movies started with Vampira in L.A., mm-hmm. who was really like a goth chick with a beatnik sort of character. And then they were always counterculture. Then beatniks really took over and they were beatniks. And then hippies took over and then they were hippies.
Right.
You know, exactly. The hippies are just the next step from beatniks. Given my choice, I would rather have been a beatnik.
Oh, I think I would have too.
Yeah, they seemed a little cooler and it just came before it got kind of creepy. It's sort of like... the difference between Pet Sounds and Smile. I think Revolver is better than Sergeant Pepper. It's just one of those. Like, okay. I like it when it has boundaries. I think it works better. I'm making no sense. What is this accent? I'm trying to have a hard time. It's a mix between.
Well, he kind of did it like this sort of. It was, hey, here comes. Oh, here's a little email from. It wasn't email back
right.
then. Here's a. An email from the future. I don't know what that is. he just did that voice. And he always said, when I first started as Son of Svengoolie, my voice, he said, sounded like a cross between Bela Lugosi and Lawrence Welk.
What was that?
And I don't really – well, it was the same thing. I'd kind of talk like this. Uh-huh. And as we went along, they had me read a lot of stuff in short periods of time, and it was hard to understand. So I started to drop the accent more and more. Now occasionally I'll roll an R. That's about all you need.
Yeah. The closer you can be to yourself, if it's a long-haul situation, the better off you are.
Yeah, and I think that's what happened. Some people were like, well, how come you don't do the accent anymore? And I said, well – I've been in this country long enough that I've lost the accent. Unlike Lawrence Welk, who was born in South Dakota, and yet still, you know, 50 years ago was going, and now here's a Baba and a Sissy with a medley of songs from a World War I. And I don't know, when we were growing up, that show was on every Saturday night. And your parents always watched it, and you had no choice in watching anything else.
Goddamn!
So you were
machine.
Sitting there with it, and now here's the storyteller Aladdin. It's like, no, not again! Oh my God!
And it was also like the '70s when it was really like so out of
date. And so, yes.
Every kid wanted to hear, don't sit under the apple tree. It's like, oh my God, kill me now.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me, he shrieked, his finger right on the trigger. and that's, I mean, that song could be taken different ways if it's lyrics are just muttered. many of the great mid-century romance songs, if you just mutter the lyrics, there it's a very different song. I can't live if living was without you. I can't live anymore.
Warden threw a party at Cook County Jail.
Well, let's break that. Let's unpack that song for one moment. Number 27 said to number 3, you're the cutest jailbird I ever did see. I sure would be delighted with your company. Come on and do the jailhouse rock with me.
Well, these
people are making love.
If you can't find a partner, use a wooden chair. Oh man.
Any Port in a Storm was the original title. And they're all dancing and you're like, wait a minute, what is this song really about? All of those songs, like a therapist would go, that's not healthy. That's not it. I've said this before, like when John and Yoko like hooked up, like, we're one person now. We're John and Yoko. And I was like, well, that's not good. that's not how it's supposed to work. But maybe now you'll write your worst music. You know, you spend one third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. Casper brand mattresses offer multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Casper mattresses provide all the support the human body needs in all the right places. Breathable designs help you sleep cool and regulate your body temperature throughout the night. They're designed, developed, and assembled in the U.S. and delivered right to your door in a small, how-do-they-do-that size box. You can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial with free shipping and returns in the U.S. and Canada. Start sleeping ahead of the curve with Casper. Get $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana at checkout. Terms and conditions apply. You heard that right. $50 towards any mattress purchase by visiting casper.com/Dana and using the promo code Dana at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
Welcome to Political Talk with two guys from Boston, a working man's look at the socio-political issues of our day. And now, Political Talk with two guys from Boston.
This is Political Talk with two guys from Boston. I'm Johnny Condon.
Robbie Sullivan here.
It's been a little bit. It's been a bit of a stretch. Yeah. A lot of people was wondering what had happened to us.
All of a sudden, the questions started coming.
We forgot.
I can't believe we completely spaced it.
We completely spaced on the fact that we had a show. We were sitting at Buzzy's Roast Beef having a sandwich.
Yeah.
They asked us, when's the next episode of the show coming back? And you could have dropped. It was like a piano fell on me.
We looked at each other like our favorite science teacher died and we didn't go to the wake.
We did. Holy shit.
Weird, right?
So here we are, and we're just going. There's a lot of news. Basically, everybody's raping everybody.
Yeah, but it turns out that that's what was appropriate at the time.
We lived in an era of a perverted zeitgeist.
It was a different age where the only way to find out what was wrong was to do it.
You know, I believe it was Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
Who called violence an evolutionary hangover.
Oh.
And I believe that this is a subset of that.
I like that idea.
I'm not making excuses. I am merely stating the fact that there has to be some reason that goes beyond everyone's an asshole.
Yeah.
And even if everyone is an asshole, there has to be a why.
Right. You can't throw everyone away for being wrong, but you can explain to them and then see what their reaction is. And if they say, oh, for God's sakes, I learned from this and I'll never, ever in a million years do this again.
Yeah.
Then you can say, okay.
Well, I'm terrified to turn on the TV every day to find out who's next.
Yeah. I'm afraid to look up and say, oh, my God, no.
Super Grover shoved his hand down Prairie Dawn's blouse, and there's no more Sesame Street.
Yeah, I don't want to hear that Mr. Rogers and the King had a thing. You know, whatever it is going to come out next. I just want my heroes to stay heroes.
Oh, there's no more heroes anymore?
It's weird.
Superman, I don't think Superman could have sex.
No. And I also,
imagine the power. It would be like straddling one of those aircraft carrier cannons.
I think what helped him for so many of the years is that he never could hire an assistant because they would know.
They would know.
And then whatever they knew would be told, which is what's happening all over the country now.
You'd know if Superman and Lois Lane ever got it on, because it would be like somebody shot her with a bazooka.
Yeah.
She's all over the place.
More than anything, I think we're talking about the misuse of power right now.
Well, it's not all of this harassment. And I'm gonna say it. It's
harassment.
It's power.
Yeah, and that's, I think, where people get in their minds. They think that something's going on that's not, and instead of discussing it with someone, they physicalize it. Big mistake.
Big mistake.
You can't do that.
And there's also I mean, I was an asshole. I was a complete asshole up until about 32.
Yeah,
Minutes ago. I was a complete asshole until Dana Hersey left the movie loft, and then I was forced to grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. I loved Dana. Dana was a wonderful influence on my life.
But did you, when all this shit started to go, did you like run through your inventory? Like, oh, Jesus, what did I do? What did I do? Wait, consensual. Consensual.
In my head, I was trying to look back and say, well, did I manipulate? Yeah, I did. Was it inappropriate? Well, all manipulation is appropriate, but thank God I never had any power.
Ah, very good.
I never used it wrong, but I never had any.
Mm-hmm.
I think some people wonder, geez, if I had that power, would I have misbehaved? Would I have done something wrong? Thank God the world of abusing your power is crumbling around us at a rate where, you know, I feel like my nieces and nephews are safe.
Well, that's the problem. I got two nieces going into the job market.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, you want these people to be treated with the respect. You know, when the first time my sister had kids, I remember her being like, don't drop that on the ground. You know, this is my sister who's now become like a litter freak because she wants it to be a nicer world for her kids.
Oh, interesting.
And I think we really are. We're picking up the litter of our society because they are trash if they're not treating people as human beings that have dreams. They want to turn into somebody better than they are, and to have someone to offer it up is like, well, you can do that if you do this, is wrong.
It's true. But have you ever been on the T and you hear you see somebody treating their kid really shitty?
Oh, yeah.
And you want to punch him in the back of the neck, but you want the middle finger extended. You make a fist, and then you extend your middle finger, and you get that right under the breach of where the skull and the spine meet.
I love films that
show
the scene.
But then the kid would think you're the bad guy.
Yeah, but I love films that show the scene that the person's just thinking about. They like go,
and then they
take out the bad guy. But then they don't actually do it. Mm. They just cut back to them going, that's what I could have done, but I'm not going to do it. Because that's what I do during those. I remember hearing like, Michael, get over here. I'm going to break your arm. And I was I just come back to Boston, and I was coming out from Logan on the train.
On the blue?
Yeah. And I hear, get over here, Michael, I'm going to break your arm. And I turn to look and figure it's some teenage kid and his dad's mad at him or something. The kid's like four.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, that I go.
Like, and you're like, oh, geez, I feel bad for the kid. But then I'm scared of the dad.
Oh, I'm
scared of him.
I revert right back.
Oh, yeah, immediately the principal's office. I'm like, oh, we're all in trouble.
Big peace,
what am I going to say? Yeah, but now I think it's really
that would be weird in the presidential
debate. I'm proud of these people that have been able to come forward and say I was treated poorly. And some of them, it doesn't look good on them, but I don't think it's supposed to. It's not a nice thing they've been through, and it's hard. You know, and I don't think that there is a witch hunt. I think when people treat someone poorly and it comes out, we're going to be able to vet this. We're going to have to start talking as a society more about this because we're going to have to figure it out.
Have you ever heard of the 100th monkey syndrome?
I have not.
I'm looking it up right now.
What's that?
This is going to knock your shit.
What, every 100th monkey wants to pull it out?
No, it's worse.
What?
100th monkey effect. I'm reading about it right now.
I can't even believe this.
This is where we are in our society today.
Yeah.
According to Wikipedia, the 100th monkey effect is a hypothetical phenomenon in which a new behavior or idea is claimed to spread rapidly by unexplained means from one group to all related groups once a critical number or members of one group exhibit the new behavior or acknowledge the new idea.
Oh, wow.
What happens is everybody gets the same idea at the same time, and society makes a giant leap
ripple
in that
effect.
Regard.
Oh, that's
yeah,
nice.
In the same way, everybody at the same time made a movie where a kid became an old guy.
Yeah.
There was like seven of them.
Yeah, it's like
big and 18 again.
Yeah.
All of them, all
so
the greats.
Someone scraped their teeth against a double stuffed Oreo. And all over the world, people started.
Yes, and yeah. We are in the 100th monkey effect right now.
Oh my gosh!
Of people
saying something,
grabbing your knob.
Yeah, and to say something is brave, but to have people now realizing I didn't want that person to be the only one that said something, since there's also a story that applies to me.
Absolutely,
is very important. Now, I think there's going to be somebody who comes out and says something untrue, but I haven't felt or seen that.
Here's my idea. If Charles Manson killed people because he was crazy and God made him crazy, then isn't he in heaven?
I don't think so.
Is everybody in heaven rolling their eyes going, oh, Jesus, the 5'4" hippie's here now?
I think heaven's, for me anyway, I think heaven's like, if we all miss you when you're gone, that's heaven. If we're all like, thank God they're not here, that's the other thing.
Oh, very good.
Does that make sense to you?
I think like everybody else, heaven looked exactly like my hometown, only this. There's clouds on the ground.
And fresh paint on the fences.
It's fresh paint. And Abe Lincoln and John Lennon are playing paddleball.
Sure. There's two people playing. There's Mark Twain's playing chess with Shirley Temple.
Exactly.
Everybody's having
a lovely time.
Yeah.
Mickey Rooney. Nobody wants to hang out with Mickey Rooney.
No inappropriate behavior.
No inappropriate behavior.
All things you need are there.
Yeah.
That's really what I think we have to start to realize as a society, is that everything's here for you. You don't got to push anyone over to get it. You got to talk to more people and be friendly and kind, and then maybe someone will be friendly and kind to you and connect.
I guess that's how it goes.
But, geez, you know how much trouble I have with dating sometimes, because, I immediately feel like just one date, and now I got to, take care of this person forever.
Oh, I'm
a jerk.
I'm the same way. I can't hook up. I never could hook up.
Because
we go on a date. We go on a date. I buy you a fribble. You accept it. and we're betrothed.
Yeah, never mind a fisherman jig. Now we're moving in.
A fisherman.
Now we're moving in together. That's a real item here in New England, by the way. A fisherman jig, you can get them over at Friendly's. You can get a fribble as well.
A fisherman jig. A Friendly's is a combination of ice cream and fish. Timeless combination of ice cream and fish.
My father was in the hospital for some treatments and stuff, and he would get me to get him a strawberry fribble. And
sure.
He would drink it, and he would go, nectar of the gods. It was the best.
My father tells a great story about getting the runs from something at the DQ. He was driving down the Cape, and he's like, oh, he had a sandwich or something at the Brazier. He had a Brazier burger. And he's like, and the minute I got on the 93, I got the cramps, and I got the window rolled down. I got my pant leg up on the on the window trying to get some cool air on me.
Oh, no.
And he had to pull off and go to a Friendly's.
Funny.
He had to go to a Friendly's to use the toilet because of something he ate at the Dairy Queen. But they made him buy something at the Friendly's to use the toilet. So he had to buy a fribble to go deal.
That's great.
And he bought a fribble. He said he should do this way all the way down to 93 South. And the part of the story I remember the most, because I tried to fart and I knew I was in trouble because it burnt.
Oh, Dad, no.
And so here's my advice.
I can picture that stretch of highway. It's right before
right before the rotary.
The rotary.
Here's our advice to wrap this up. Men out there, we're not making excuses for anybody, but we're here to give you practical tools to make the world a better place.
Yeah.
If you feel like you are about to abuse your power and act out in a way that is ungentlemanly, first, to the person to whom you are planning this, pull them aside and give them your best diarrhea story. We all have one.
That's inappropriate behavior, but it's more appropriate than what you were about to do.
It's like a pre-burn. You know, it's like a fire break.
If this is okay.
Sometimes to stop a fire, you have to light another fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when the two fires meet, they cancel each other out. That's called a fire break.
You know, if you're the assistant manager to Dunkin' Donuts, you still have power over Cheryl and Tony.
Every man has prurient interests. Yeah. And every man has at least one diarrhea story.
That's true.
Use that.
Yeah.
Let that be the kryptonite. If there's anything that I can tell you, it's let diarrhea be your kryptonite.
I think that. How do we top that?
I think we're done.
We can't.
Political Talk with Two Guys from Boston.
It all started, in part, with a $1,000 loan from somebody's mom. In 1953, a University of Illinois psychology graduate, who was at the time writing ad copy for Esquire magazine, had an idea for a magazine of his own. At the time, he called it Stag Party. Unfortunately, there was a men's adventure magazine at the time called Stag. And so, young Hugh Hefner set about finding another title. Considered and rejected were Top Hat, Gentleman, Sir, Satyr, Pan, Bachelor, and finally his friend Eldon Sellers suggested Playboy. The first issue didn't have a date because they were afraid there might not be a second issue. Its success was assured, however, when Hefner bought a nude image of then reigning screen siren Marilyn Monroe. Monroe had taken the photos in 1949 for photographer Tom Kelly. She was a struggling actress at the time and in between jobs. She agreed to sit for the photos on two conditions. One, that Kelly actually pay her the promised sum of $50, and that his wife be present at all times to ensure there be no hanky of the panky variety. The photos surfaced on a calendar in 1952, right as Marilyn Monroe was breaking. But despite this being the puritanical 1950s, she risked having her rising star prematurely extinguished by refusing to deny that that was indeed her in the photos. Instead, she told the truth. She was a young, starving actress. She needed money. And the public forgave her. And it actually added to her stardom. Again, for the 50s, this was unheard of. Hugh Hefner purchased the photos for $500. And for that teeny tiny sum, launched a multi-million dollar publishing empire. Playboy magazine, or what it was, has to be viewed in the context of its era. Aside from the fact that it did indeed lead the march in the objectification of women, not to mention the normalization of the loose definition of pornography. And yes, later in life, Hefner himself descended into a bizarre parody of his former life, ensconced in his decaying West Los Angeles mansion like a horny Howard Hughes, living out a sad, gothic, Viagra-infused recreation of his swinging heyday. But life is full of subtlety and nuance. So what I'm saying is, yes, in this enlightened era, the Playboy philosophy is an eye-roller at best. But Hugh Hefner and Playboy did do some things that were pretty cool. In 1955, Playboy published The Crooked Man, a piece of fiction by future Twilight Zone staff writer Charles Beaumont. The story depicted a culture in which homosexuality was the norm and heterosexuals were the minority. This was quite a bold step in the straight-laced mid-50s, when homosexuality in the United States was still illegal. That's right, illegal. The story demonstrated how it's unfair for one group to be mistreated when those roles could be so obviously switched. When readers wrote in complaints, Hefner responded with, "If it was wrong to persecute heterosexuals in a homosexual society, then the reverse is wrong too." Hefner was a strong and vocal proponent of racial equality, autism awareness, environmental causes. He published Lenny Bruce's How to Talk Dirty and Influence People when no one else would go near it. As a philanthropist, Hugh Hefner single-handedly saved the Hollywood sign twice, once in 1978 and once in 2010. The debate as to whether or not Playboy's positive contributions outweigh its negatives will go on and on and on. An article in the British version of GQ summed up the two sides somewhat tidily. During its heyday, Playboy told its readers that a new morality had replaced the old taboos. Indeed, Playboy helped liberate a generation from the past. Playboy's use of photos of the girl next door and décolletage, Hefner would tell you, made sex acceptable in a buttoned-up society, freeing men and women from the prudery and repression of the 50s, and laying the foundation for the sexual revolution of the next decade. This seems an awfully heavy piece of sociological baggage for a magazine like Playboy to carry. Another way of putting it is that Hefner realized men would pay money to see pictures of girls with their tops off. You British. And so it goes. But aside from the pictures during Playboy's heyday, stretching through the 50s up into the early 80s, it published the works of such literary giants as Saul Bellow, John Updike, John Cheever, Doris Lessing, Joyce Carol Oates, Vladimir Nabokov, Michael Crichton, Kurt Vonnegut, and Sexton. For years, the in-depth and long-form Playboy interview was conducted by Roots author Alex Haley. Haley interviewed Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X in the magazine's pages. John Lennon's Playboy interview appeared in the January 1981 issue and was, in fact, on the stands at the time of Lennon's death. It would later go on to be published as a book. Playboy peaked early. Its circulation hit its high in 1970 when it sold just under 8 million issues a month, a staggering number. But what goes up must come down. Every party has to end. To every Woodstock, an Altamont. For every Tim Burton's Ed Wood, there's Tim Burton's Planet of the Apes. And the first dark cloud on Hugh Hefner's seemingly limitless horizon came, of course, in the form of a tall, buxom, blue-eyed blonde, which was the kind of women Hefner preferred. He wrote in 1963, quote, "Consider the kind of girl we made popular in the Playmate of the Month. She is never sophisticated, a girl you cannot really have. She is a young, healthy, simple girl, the girl next door. We are not interested in the mysterious, difficult woman, the femme fatale, who wears elegant underwear with lace, and she is sad and somehow mentally filthy." End quote. Okay there, Hugh. No need for Freud here. A sophisticated woman you can't effortlessly have must be somehow sad and mentally filthy. Gotcha. How much do you want to bet Hugh Hefner's mother was... Nah, never mind. I can't. We'll be here all day. Anyway, no one idealized Hefner's view of the ideal woman. Woman, because it implies maturity, must be taken in quotes, more than Dorothy Hoogstraten. And fitting for a magazine devoted to illusion, this all-American beauty was from Vancouver, not America. One of the big illusions of Playboy was that as a model, you would appear in it, captivate the world, and become a star. Only, that never really happened. Well, it kinda almost did. Once. Whether or not it would have worked, we will never know. Dorothy Hoogstraten was working at a Dairy Queen in Western Canada when she met Paul Snyder. Snyder was 9 years her senior and drove a Corvette. Nuff said. Eventually, he convinced her to take some nude photos, which he then submitted to Playboy magazine, and before you know it, Dorothy Hoogstraten was on an airplane for the very first time in her life, headed towards Los Angeles and Hugh Hefner's mansion. With her last name abbreviated to just Stratton, the former Dairy Queen clerk became Playboy's August 1979 Playmate and later 1980's Playmate of the Year. Unlike previous Playmates with aspirations for the big screen, Dorothy Stratton did actually get work. She appeared on Fantasy Island, Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and co-starred with Kirk Douglas in the big screen sci-fi comedy Galaxina. She was then cast in Peter Bogdanovich's comedy, They All Laughed. And all of this was great, as long as Paul Snyder came along for the ride. Sensing that Dorothy was slipping out of his grasp, Snyder proposed, and despite being warned off by Hefner, who said Snyder had a pimp-like quality, Dorothy Stratton went ahead with the wedding. But Snyder didn't marry Stratton because he loved her. He married her to own and control her, and the marriage was doomed from the start. Just how doomed? No one could fathom. It was on the New York set of They All Laughed that Dorothy Stratton's love affair with director Peter Bogdanovich became apparent. Stratton went so far as to move into his hotel suite. This was no secret to Paul Snyder, who had hired a private detective. Once the film wrapped, the couple moved back to Los Angeles, where Dorothy intended to divorce Snyder and marry Bogdanovich. Why can't you just date? On the night of August 14, 1980, Stratton was summoned to Snyder's West Hollywood home, where she had hoped that they could talk things through, settle their differences amicably, and move on with their lives. Instead, Snyder, armed with a recently purchased 12-gauge shotgun, killed Dorothy Stratton and then took his own life. When writing about Stratton's tragic life in his memoir, The Killing of the Unicorn, Peter Bogdanovich laid a heaping helping of the blame for her death at the feet of Hugh Hefner, going so far as to accuse Hefner of forcing himself on the naive young centerfold. Hefner strenuously denied the charge and later cited Bogdanovich's book as contributing to the stress that would later cause him to have a stroke. It would be ironic indeed if Playboy ceased publication because of a stroke. And it did not. Playboy went on, and so did Hugh Hefner, albeit both in gradually diminishing capacities. 2 years after Dorothy Stratton's murder, Hugh Hefner's daughter Christy became the president of Playboy Enterprises. She became the CEO in 1988. She ran the company quite successfully for 20 years, helping navigate the brand through the digital age, which posed a special threat to Playboy. And as much as it made magazines archaic and pictures of girls with their boobs showing not so much easy to access as hard to avoid. And through it all, Hef remained true to his swinger lifestyle, even as culture and the world around him changed, growing at once less fearful of taboos and at the same time more conservative. In the early 2000s, Hefner stumbled onto a bizarre cultural renaissance with the show The Girls Next Door, a, quote, reality, unquote, show about Hugh and his three girlfriends, Holly Madison, Bridget Marquardt, and Kendra Wilkinson. The show ran for 6 years. After the show was canceled, the female stars of The Girls Next Door, who supposedly were not paid, began writing books. And the true grand guignol nature of Hefner in his dotage came to light. Think Howard Hughes with a Viagra-infused perma-boner. By the time the 21st century rolled around, Hefner turned 74 in the year 2000, life in the Playboy mansion had settled into a very predictable pattern. Like most men in his 70s and 80s, Hefner had three blonde young girlfriends with giant fake boobs. The week fell into a predictable pattern. Monday night was manly night, where Hef would have his dude buddies over for dinner and a movie. Tuesday was family night, where Hefner's wife and two sons, who lived in the house next door to the Playboy mansion, would come over for family time. Wednesday night was club night, when Hefner and his girlfriends, who had to be prepped and ready to go by 10 p.m., would be taken out to some elite Los Angeles night spot. His girlfriends were expected to remain at the table with Hefner. If they did dance, they could dance, but only within sight of the table. Bathroom breaks were permitted, but were encouraged to be kept brief. Thursday was an off night, and Hefner's girlfriends were free to do anything they wanted, as long as it didn't involve another man, and they were home by 9 p.m. That's right, 9 p.m. Friday night was another club night, and Saturday was a buffet dinner and a movie hangout, just chilling with Hef around the house. Sunday was a swimming pool party, followed by dinner and another goddamn movie. Hefner's girlfriends were given an allowance of $1,000 a week, which he would hand to them every Friday morning in person. According to one-time Hefner girlfriend Isabella St. James, quote, "Every Friday morning we had to go to Hef's room, wait while he picked up all the dog poo off the carpet, and then ask for our allowance. $1,000 counted out and crisp $100 bills from a safe in one of his bookcases. We all hated this process. Hefner would always use the occasion to bring up anything he wasn't happy about in the relationship. Most of the complaints were about the lack of harmony among the girlfriends or the lack of sexual participation in the parties he held in his bedroom. Hugh Hefner died in 2017 at the age of 91 after going into cardiac arrest and experiencing respiratory failure. He was also suffering from acute E. coli and septicemia, which is a nice way of saying blood poisoning. He was buried in a plot alongside Marilyn Monroe that he purchased in 1992. He didn't ask her permission the first time he hitched his wagon to her star. I can't imagine she is very thrilled about the second. Great story if it ends there, right? Well, it doesn't have to, not for you. Go to the library page at danagould.com. Find links to purchase many of the books and films mentioned in this month's show, including John Hodgman's Vacation Land, the Bob Fosse film Star 80 with Eric Roberts and Mariel Hemingway playing Paul Snyder and Dorothy Stratton, Down the Rabbit Hole by Playboy playmate Holly Madison, and Bunny Tales Behind Closed Doors at the Playboy Mansion. Both of these books will give you a lot more info than you probably want. Hey, speaking of info you probably don't want, there's Mr. Funny Man, the new comedy album by yours truly, me. Also on the homepage of danagould.com, you'll see options to donate to the show or subscribe through PayPal. Every cent goes back into the show, and please know we appreciate what, if anything, you can do. But that's not all. You can visit our store at comedyfilmnerds.com for Bevilacqua Heating and Air Conditioning t-shirts, Dana Gould Hour t-shirts, signed vinyl copies of Funhouse, Let Me Put My Thoughts in You, and I Know It's Wrong. It's all here, it's all online, and it's all for you, baby. Thanks to HelloFresh.com for supporting our podcast. The Dana Gould Hour has teamed up with HelloFresh, and they're offering everyone in our audience $30 off your first week of deliveries when you go to HelloFresh.com and use the offer code DGH30. HelloFresh is delivered to your doorstep in a recyclable insulated box. You can choose your delivery date and pause it if you're out of town. They offer a wide variety of chef-curated recipes that change weekly, and there are three plans to choose from: classic, veggie, and family. You won't spend all night in the kitchen because recipes only take around 30 minutes. There are lots of one-pot recipes for seriously speedy cooking and minimal cleanup. Feel confident with the simple recipes outlined on pictured step-by-step instruction cards. And try things you'd never think to cook on your own. And enjoy eating outside of your comfort zone. I'm a single dad, and my kids think I'm about as good a cook as I am a ballroom dancer. So HelloFresh has really been a godsend. Not only is the food great, its preparation is essentially idiot-proof, and I am a living example. Last week, I made winner-winner chicken orzo dinner with cheesy roasted zucchini and tomato, and it was great. My 15-year-old actually said, "Dad, I can honestly say this is not terrible." Which, if you've spent any time around a 15-year-old, you know is pretty much a rave. Go to HelloFresh.com and use the code DGH30 to get $30 off your first week of deliveries. That's HelloFresh.com, using the code DGH30 to get $30 off your first week of deliveries.
Yes, there's an air about hot coffee that's hard to resist. Full-bodied, refreshing hot coffee makes any time a pleasant interlude. Won't you have some now?
Well, ladies and gentlemen, here is a very shocking comedian, the most shocking comedian of our time, a young man who is skyrocketing to fame, Lenny Bruce. Here he is.
Lenny Bruce. Like his cultural soulmate Bob Dylan, or George Gershwin, or Pablo Picasso, or the list goes on and on, he took an entire art form, tore it apart, and remade it in his own image. Born Leonard Alfred Schneider in upstate New York, Lenny's parents divorced when he was so young he could barely remember them together. As a teenager, he spent some time on a farm and liked it so much, he enlisted in the Navy and fought in World War II just to get away from it. Lenny served with distinction on the SS Brooklyn. He saw action in Northern Africa and at Anzio, but following an impromptu comedy performance for his crewmates that happened to have been performed in drag, his commanding officer thought Lenny might be homosexual. And Lenny did everything he could to convince his commanding officer that he was correct. And so Lenny was discharged dishonorably. He appealed, and it was later changed to under honorable conditions but unsuitable for service. Lenny started his comedy career in New York, but in the early days was considered a capable but uninspired performer. At the behest of his mother, Sally Marr, herself a stand-up comic and singer-dancer, Lenny made his national radio debut in 1948 on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts. It got him work in some very traditional venues, the hotels up in the Catskill Mountains, what they call the Borscht Belt, but Lenny's heart wasn't in it. It was around this time that Lenny met and fell in love with Harriet Joliffe, a stripper with the stage name Honey Harlow. And somewhere along the way, Lenny and Honey fell in love with heroin. And people addicted to heroin do silly things.
There were kids, 8 and 9 years old, that were sniffing airplane glue to get high on. Hello, Schindler. Nice the way you got here. Give me a nickel's worth of pencils, big boy tablet, some juju beans, Tailspin Tommy book, and 2,000 tubes of airplane glue.
Lenny had an idea to make money by posing as a priest, Brother Matthias, and in the name of the Brother Matthias Foundation, began raising money for a leper colony in New Guinea. He raised a lot of money, but he kept most of it, and that's illegal. He and Honey also got into a brutal car accident that nearly killed them both, and so, shaken and chastened by the law, they said goodbye to the East Coast and headed west. They first moved to San Francisco, where Lenny returned to stand-up and began to develop what would become his quite revolutionary style. Rapid-fire, stream-of-conscious, off-the-cuff improvisations, the vocal equivalent of bebop. It even took its name from jazz. Riffing.
Like a lady can't go through a plate glass window and go to bed with you 5 seconds later. But guys can have head-on collisions with Greyhound buses in disaster areas. Everybody's laying dead on the highway. Not only the hospital and the ambulance, the guy makes play for the nurse.
Lenny, Honey, and their new daughter Kitty were onto something, but they weren't quite there yet. So they moved south to Los Angeles. The greased-up, jazzed-up, pilled-up, hopped-up, beatnik-driven, bongo-narrated Los Angeles of the late 1950s. And in Los Angeles, Lenny followed his wife back into strip clubs. Strip clubs. You see, despite having worked in the upscale hotels of the Catskill Mountains and at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco, Lenny Bruce purposefully chose the lowest rung available on the comedy ladder, emceeing strip joints. And there, among society's outcasts, jazzbos, beatniks, strippers, hookers, pimps, and other pill-popping fiends, Lenny discovered himself. With nobody looking, Lenny Bruce reached down inside of himself and pulled out an artist. Among society's outcasts, Lenny Bruce became their tribune. He was raw, he was filthy, he was brilliant, and he talked about things no other comedian dared discuss.
How do you relax colored people at parties? And in the bit, I play the white guy. I didn't get your name.
Miller.
Miller, my name is Anderson.
Anderson, glad to know you.
Pleasure indeed, sir. Mm-hmm. Pleasure indeed. You know that Joe Louis was a hell of a fighter.
Yeah, you can say that again. Joe Louis was a hell of a fighter.
Credit to your race. Don't you forget it, you son of a gun.
Well, thank you very much.
That's perfect. All right. Here's the Bojangles.
Yeah, here's the Bojangles.
What the hell, that guy? You know that guy in a cream of wheat box?
No, I don't know him on the cream of wheat box.
Oh, well. Here's the Stepan Fetcher.
Yeah, here's the Stepan Fetcher.
At the height of the civil rights movement, Lenny Bruce did bits about race on stage that I don't think you could even get away with today.
By the way, are there any niggers here tonight?
Are there any niggers here tonight? Is he that desperate for shock value? Did he scrape the bottom bound to be that cruel to say, are there any niggers here tonight?
Are there any niggers here? You know I'm working with a nigger. I think I see one nigger couple back there between those two niggers to three kikes. Thank God for the kikes. And two spicks and one mick. We have two spicks, one mick, three kikes, and one spunky, funky, hunky. Any more boogies? Three more sheenies, eight more guineas, six guineas, seven wops, six grease balls. I pass the six dykes, four kikes, and eight niggers. The point.
Lenny Bruce used his powers for good. He took down people in positions of authority, hypocrisy, racism, and his controversial, filthy brilliance catapulted him to stardom. Despite being one of the most famous stand-up comedians of all time, I think, he only made about six television appearances. At the peak of his success, on February 4th, 1961, 1 month after John F. Kennedy was sworn into office, Lenny Bruce performed a midnight concert at Carnegie Hall. Despite a blizzard so brutal it caused a driving ban in New York City, 3,000 people walked through 2 feet of snow and packed out the joint to listen to Lenny Bruce riff until 2 a.m. Great story if it ends there. It doesn't. The problem is, by taking on people in positions of power, Lenny Bruce made a lot of enemies in positions of power. And his drug habit left him very, very vulnerable. On October 4th, 1961, Lenny was arrested while performing at the Jazz Workshop in San Francisco for obscenity. In the words of Bruce biographer Paul Krasner, Lenny used the word cocksucker to describe a cocksucker and was arrested for aptness in language. He was acquitted, but the word was out. Lenny Bruce was an easy mark and it'll get your name in the paper for doing it. And Lenny Bruce's audiences began to be filled not only by fans, but by undercover police officers waiting to arrest him. He was arrested in Philadelphia for drug possession. He was arrested in Los Angeles, in West Hollywood, for saying the word schmuck. Nowhere is the persecution of Lenny Bruce more perfectly symbolized than in the case of the famous Gate of Horn nightclub in Chicago. Lenny, at the time, free on bail from his arrest in Los Angeles, was preparing to perform at the preeminent nightclub in the Windy City. The very beautiful, very hip, very Catholic, Windy City. Before he ever entered the club, the Chicago Police Vice Squad warned the club's owner that if Lenny Bruce used four-letter words in their club or spoke out against religion in any way, he would arrest everyone in the club and suspend their liquor license. To quote, "He mocks the Pope, and I'm speaking as a Catholic. You're in danger of losing your license." The Vice Squad had men in the show at every show. Guess what? Lenny Bruce was arrested, and the Gate of Horn's liquor license was suspended. Chicago had the largest membership in the Roman Catholic Church of any archdiocese in the country. At the trial, Lenny, a Jew, faced a jury consisting entirely of Catholics. The judge was Catholic. The prosecutor and his assistant were Catholic. Variety reported, "The prosecutor is at least equally concerned with Bruce's indictments of organized religion as he is with the more obvious sexual content of the Comics Act. It's possible that Bruce's comments on the Catholic Church have hit a sensitive nerve in Chicago's Catholic-oriented administration and police department." One might say that is accusation by understatement. The jury found Lenny guilty. The judge gave him the maximum penalty, 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine, basically for telling dirty jokes. He was arrested 15 times within the next 2 years. By this time, his battles with the law were consuming him. He felt persecuted, probably because he was being persecuted. He was being hounded out of existence, and it showed on stage. His once brilliant act had devolved into a long, rambling commentary on his battles with the law.
You've got the attorney for the people. You've got the attorney for the defense. Let me tell you something about attorneys. Well, any kind of... the best attorneys are the attorneys that do it every day. And the administration of criminal justice, they had the broad, broad field. The best attorneys were the Justice Department, the DA that's been with it for 10 years, forget it, called coming near him.
Nowhere was safe for Lenny Bruce. In April of 1964, he was arrested during a performance at the Café Agogo in Greenwich Village. Along with the club's owners, this was intentional. The police were trying very hard to discourage anyone from hiring him. His trial dragged on for 6 months. He was convicted on obscenity charges and sentenced to 4 months in a workhouse. His case went on appeal. But before it was resolved, on August 3rd, 1966, Lenny Bruce was found dead in his home in the Hollywood Hills. The cause was acute morphine poisoning, an overdose. The police, on his ass, even in death, allowed the press in to photograph him lying naked, bloated, and dead on his bathroom floor, the needle still dangling out of his arm. But Lenny Bruce, like Obi-Wan Kenobi, became more powerful in death than he ever was in life. The doors he broke down were never closed again. They stayed down. Lenny Bruce lived in an America where you could get arrested for saying cocksucker on stage. And the fact that that seems so ridiculous now is thanks only to him. His tombstone reads, "Beloved father, devoted son, peace at last."
All alone. All alone, I'll be rich, but so all alone.
And now, on with the show.
You and I are both going to live a lot longer than we want to. I think that we're...
No, I... Well, that's interesting.
I'm going to run up close to 100. I know. Barring a bus or a bullet.
Yeah, I don't know. But I will say that I don't know that I'll ever not want to live.
Mm-hmm.
Like, when you say,
But I do wonder if it gets... Well, I don't know. Does your life become like the end of the day? Like last night, it was, I flew in last night and I was the time change and daylight savings and,
right.
You know, I have work to do it at about 10 o'clock. I was going to sit down and work for about 2-3 hours.
10 o'clock at night?
Yeah.
Oh, Dana, yeah. No.
That's my life. And I put my youngest daughter to bed and I lied down with her
and then
that was it.
Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
But I was like, I could have got up. I was like, oh, screw this.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder if at the end of your life you're just like, yeah, I'm done. But I got to tell you, I had very, very...
Not in my experience.
But on the other hand, I will say I was incredibly lucky.
Yeah.
I got to work with Mel Brooks a lot 2 months ago. Spent a lot of time with Mel. Mel's 92 and is 26.
Yeah.
You know?
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's in London right now.
Right.
With the Young Frankenstein musical.
Right.
There's a new book. And he's... completely engaged and on fire. So, I look at that as compared to Hugh Hefner, who I am obsessed with. Just
right.
You talk about the things he was still having sex up until the end.
Right.
And I think I try to, let's go. Let's tick it off. When you die, people say you're in a better place. They've gone to a better place.
Sure.
I don't know if Hugh Hefner's in a better place. being the only judge in a 60-year-old blowjob competition is a pretty good place to be.
It might get tiresome,
though. I wonder if up in heaven, they're like, I just think I'll have a blowjob and play pinball with Jimmy Kahn. Actually, we're not so big on the O-job blaze up here. How about some mixed nuts and a harp lesson?
I would say that maybe... Well, first of all, you're presuming he's going to heaven.
I think.
If there were such a place.
If there is a place.
Right. Which I think the jury is out.
I think you would rather be in hell where he knows people.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And then... But I would also say, there probably was a time when Hugh Hefner might have said, this is boring to me
But
now.
I know that he was still having these creepy... horrifying orgies. Or
yeah, because he had to, because he felt it was his brand. Don't
yeah,
you think?
But, like, but and the specifics of them, I'm not going to get into here, but it's great.
Thank you.
There's
uh-huh.
there's a book that tells the real sort of Poe. Uh-huh. Poet, you know, it's like the fall of the House of Usher with
right.
with priapism, and if that's pronounced correctly. And I wonder what his body was saying. Why are you doing this?
Right.
You know, as I've said, I will never watch a withered chicken neck ejaculate dust again and not think of Hugh Hefner.
When my grandmother died, my father's mother,
uh-huh.
she was a Catholic person of faith. And she was like, take me, God, I'm ready now. Like,
yeah.
She thought she was going someplace.
Sure.
And if you really have that faith,
as it was described so perfectly in The Empire Strikes Back, Cloud City.
Cloud City, exactly. she had already put a down payment on a condo in yeah. Cloud City.
Yeah,
she was on a one. She had a staff one-way of Ugnaughts. that's a ref.
Yeah, nice.
That's a ref. I got it. I got that one
that
in
was
there.
Good. On a one-way yeah. ticket to Bespin.
That's right. But you know, if you are a person of doubt. Or no faith, and frankly, right. I think even the most faithful, honest, faithful people have doubt. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, you have to have doubt, or you're a lunatic.
If you were an atheist like my mom, who gave up her Catholicism, religious Catholicism or cultural mm-hmm. Catholicism, stayed and got passed down to me with anxiety, guilt, and love of fatty foods.
Right.
And you're dying at the age of 58, and your dumb son comes in who only understands death in the context of movies and television.
Sure.
And he says to you, like, so, Mom, are you at peace with the idea of death? And my mom looked at me and she's like, what's wrong with you? No.
Yeah.
I don't want to die. And I was like, right. And
good. Okay, yeah. Good.
And there are times, so my mom passed away when I was 29. She was 58. And this is why we got this house in Western Massachusetts. And, that's another moment in your life when you lose someone like that, where you're like, I'm done. Like, there's nothing can be healed. You know, yeah. Nothing. The world is broken.
There's also there's an Irish thing,
right?
That I think growing up Irish and like having John F. Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy plates
right.
on display, and it was like literally like you live, and then one day someone shoots you in the head,
right?
And that's how it goes.
Yeah,
and there's a very fatalistic thing.
Mm-hmm.
John McGinley, who's 100% Irish.
Sure.
And we were on the set of the show.
His middle name is C for Celtic.
Yeah, exactly. It's actually, yeah. If you cut him, he bleeds Lucky Charms. but it's so funny. We were sitting on the bed in the bedroom set of the show.
Yeah.
And he is like my brother. Like he looks like my brother.
Yeah.
He's funny the way my brother's funny.
Yeah.
He's crazy the way my brother's crazy.
Yeah.
And I say that knowing he's listening.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a great, we have a lovely, great relationship that I really value. And we're sitting in the bed and the cameraman is measuring, and they measure with these infrared lights now. They don't do the
right.
They don't do the tape measure. They just
right.
do the light and it comes up. And so we're sitting there.
I want one of those things
and
so
this,
bad.
This little green dot goes on both of us.
Uh-huh.
As if a sniper rifle was aiming at us. And we looked at each other and for a half a second
yeah.
had that like had a good run. Like, literally like, yeah, this yeah. is how it ends.
Yeah.
And then both of us, without saying a word, burst out laughing, both of us knowing what the other person was thinking.
Right, because like, of that Irish-American
yeah, fatalism. That's how it goes.
Plus, the light itself was green.
Yeah,
it's like, here comes
exactly,
the destiny of the Irish.
Exactly.
And that would have been a strange alternate universe headline. Stand against evil sniper strikes again. Like one guy.
Yeah, not, hates the show. You're in college in the early 70s, mm-hmm. and this is a very non-groovy thing. Like, were you always like super into all of this stuff, Stooges and old horror movies? And
oh, sure.
Like that.
Yeah. That was my
Did you read Famous Monsters?
Then. Of course.
Sure.
Yeah. I still have some of the ones that I had back in that era.
So do I. So do I. Yeah. In fact, everybody does.
There's this magazine called, I've talked about it ad nauseum on the podcast, called Famous Monsters. I'm sure somebody in this audience must have been reading it when they were kids. And from Spielberg down, people read it. And I know Greg Nicotero from The Walking Dead has like a complete run.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Really?
And it's like, it's leather bound. like, there's my famous monsters and you can't touch them. And,
mine are all so beat up from, reading them over and over and over again.
Yeah. And it had they had a mail order company in the back. Again, all of these things from a bygone era called Captain Company.
Right. Yes.
And you could get a monkey.
You could get a monkey. You could also get what do they call them?
Monkey in the Mail. Now, there's a Morrissey song he's never recorded. Monkey in the Mail. I think I've got a monkey in the mail.
The Chihuahua in the teacup.
Chihuahua in the teacup. Yes. A submarine, which was a two-dimensional cardboard cutout of a submarine. A 6-foot Frankenstein poster.
Yes, rubber masks of all kinds.
Right,
giant
balloon. Do you remember the human-sized balloon? Yeah, you could get all of this stuff, but you look at those things and it is like a time machine. Like you get instantly transported back. So you're in college, you're a big fan of this stuff, and you start writing into this guy, Jerry Bishop, and then you start to work for him,
As it became a video show, and he would do songs and parodies of commercials and things, and he started to ask me to write specific things for him. He said, there's a commercial on now for this, Arizona land that a local disc jockey did. And he said, can you write me a parody of that? And, local car dealers and things like that. So I started doing that. And one day he said, hey, why don't you just come in while we're taping? And I thought, oh, that's cool. I'll go in there. And he said, you do voices, right? And I said, well, yeah. He said, here, why don't you do this off-camera voice and this? And eventually it built into me working with him. And quite honestly, everybody says, oh, you were really trying to get a job. I wasn't even trying to get it. I was just so thrilled that he liked the stuff that I did.
Yeah,
and it was just so cool to be hanging around with him and, when he was doing the TV show.
Em and I were talking about this, of just like, just do what you do and things will. I never set out to get hired on The Simpsons. I kind of fell into it. And people hate me for that story. but it was just like I knew a friend of mine worked on the show and I ended up going in a day a week to help out on jokes. And then one day he's like, you want to just come every day? I was like, yeah, sure.
Sure. And just because you like it and it's fun and it's so cool to be doing it.
Exactly. It's the reason I love your show so much now, because the late 60s, early 70s, it was a very heavy time. It's hard to imagine nowadays, but the person who was the president was kind of crazy. I know it's hard to imagine what that was like. It was very, he was intentionally divisive of the culture and that, it people do that because it works. It doesn't necessarily have to be good for the country as a whole, but it does work politically. And it was the war and it was really heavy, and the comedy at the time, George Carlin and Richard Pryor when they were coming, it was heavy. A lot of portent behind it. I'm not saying it's not brilliant. I love it, but there's also something beautiful and freeing about just the silliness and the ridiculousness of doing stuff like Svengoolie and Stooges and making fun of Plan 9 from Outer Space. There's sort of like a palate cleansing, a mental aperitif. You kind of just like, what? And that's how Steve Martin became Steve Martin. He was just so tired of all the heaviness of comedy. He just wanted to be silly and ridiculous.
Yeah, when I do appearances now, people have come up to me and they say, it's really nice with everything that's going on in the world to be able to watch you and, just enjoy the silliness and get some laughs out of it.
I agree 70%. No, no, I agree 100%.
I demand a recount.
It's so true. It's just like parrots crawling into turkeys. This is my new favorite thing. I do have false idols and it's a parrot and a turkey. and then the turkey would fly away. That's a strong parrot.
Oh, yeah. Or like the one that in one of the Stooges, where there's a parrot that's inside a skull. And, first it's walking around. And it's like, well, he's got good leg strength. And then it starts flying around the room. Now, imagine this. A parrot with this huge calcium deposit. And here it is, soaring around, above them. Of course, their reaction is,
hey.
Most of us would also do, I think.
Yeah. Or if you were watching, just Larry going, hey, that skull's flying.
Shut up, nothing's flying around here.
I just like Larry going over his dialogue. Open the door, Mo. Hey, Mo. Knock it off, Mo.
Okay.
He shared a lot of lines with Zeppo Marx. Hey, fellas, somebody's coming.
Who's at the door? One of my favorite lines is, I like Shemp more than Curly.
I'm a big Shemp fan.
Yeah, I'm a big Shemp fan. But I like Larry more than Shemp. I could just isolate on Larry in the middle of and watch everything. But one of my favorite lines ever in The Stooges, I still say it, was a Shemp line where she goes, they're in the haunted house, the Scottish house, and she goes, I'm Lorna Doone. And he goes, hi, Lorna, how you doing?
I told you about my bit. You know, in real life, supposedly, poor Shemp passed away either on the way to or coming home from some professional boxing. The story goes that he was just, you know, lighting a cigar, and suddenly the cigar fell from his fingers, and he was dead. And I always thought you could do that as one of the shorts. You know, I mean, the august name would be something like The Death of Shemp, but, you know, the name they'd use was something like Croaking Jokers or something like that. So they're all in the back of the cab, and
Croaking Jokers.
And Shemp goes, hey, fellas, I really don't feel so good. Shut up. You want to ruin our fun night at the boxing match? Come on. Hey, Mo, I think there is something wrong with him.
I'm leaving, fellas.
Hey, Mo, he dropped his cigar. Well, no use wasting it. Give it to me.
My mom.
That would end.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
It would have started with a line of dialogue like, well, here we are on our way to the boxing match.
Or it would have been Vernon Dent telling him, now you boys, I'm making you go to the boxing match because you can cover it for my newspaper. And whatever you do, make sure you get the story.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, and Shem would have a portent line like, we're dying to go. And then what would happen was they wouldn't realize that Shemp was dead because a parrot would have crawled under his coat, and he would have just like.
Hey, Shemp, what's it like outside? Jeepers creepers, what a night.
You head, Shemp, he wants a cracker.
Boy. Who's Polly? I don't know.
I'll get him a cracker. Again, Bruce Campbell told me that when they were in college in Michigan, they just called the Screen Actors Guild retirement home, and they just said, we'd like to speak to Larry Fine. They're like, hold. And it was like Bruce and Sam Raimi and maybe Scott Spiegel or somebody, and they called up, and they're like,
hello?
Hi, Larry. We're going to school in Michigan, and we're just big fans of yours.
Really? And you're going to school?
And then we're just big fans. And then they just had this really casual conversation with him. And then in the middle of it, Larry just goes, "Jesus Christ, it's 4:30."
By the way, since you said that John McGinley is listening,
yeah.
I loved you and Dean Koontz's intensity, John McGinley. My first introduction to your work, a television movie on Fox, uh-huh. Carter, adapting a very scary novel by Dean Koontz.
Yep.
And I remember distinctly, and I can only remember it because it was never released as far as I can tell, or if it was released on videotape, it is no longer available. There are parts of it on YouTube and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But I learned so much about storytelling and acting.
Oh, wow.
From this one moment where McGinley's character is calling into work. He's a police officer and he's calling into work to say he's going to be late. And he sort of has this nice banter with mm-hmm. his coworker on the other line. And he hangs up the phone and he just kind of stares into the middle distance for a second and goes, great guy to no one. And what we know as the audience is that this character, John C. McGinley's character, has a child locked in a vault in his basement. and he's this terrifying murderer.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And torturer and sociopath.
Right.
But whether it was in the script or improvised or whatever it was, that detail.
Yes, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Looking into the middle distance and going, that's a great guy. Like, suddenly chilled me. And it was one of those first moments where I understand, right, the villain never thinks they're the villain.
No.
The villain always thinks they're the hero, and the hero can have friends and can appreciate a decent dude at work. You know what I mean? Like, you know what's nice? That guy always saves a donut for me. Sometimes I bring it home to my captured child.
Exactly. Well, one of my favorite little moments in the Universal Classics is Dwight Frye, who plays the hunchbacked assistant Carl,
right,
in the original Frankenstein.
Right.
Is one of the and Carl Frankenstein is one of the fathers of the character that I play on Stand Against Evil.
Got it.
It's the night of the experiment. It's thunder. It's lightning. There's a corpse on the table.
Sure.
And somebody comes to the door and he has to climb up these treacherous steps and he stops halfway to pull up his socks. Which for the, for the 30s too is incredibly, advanced because his actor's name is Dwight Frye. Mm-hmm. And he was an incredibly modern actor in these very mannered movies. If you, especially Dracula and Frankenstein, a lot of what's wrong with you, darling?
Yeah.
Don't you know? And he was just
how dare you come in here?
Yeah, and he was a very unmannered, very like
naturalistic. Yeah,
he was Renfield in Dracula, and he has the best laugh in the movie where he goes, "I bid you welcome." And he goes, "Good to see you." he plays it very normally.
So, do you think he pulled up his socks in that moment as a sort of
completely improvised?
Improvised,
yeah, I can totally feel it. Yeah,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's awesome, incredible.
But I wanted to read something before you go. I wanted to read my favorite part of the one of my favorite quotes. And I want you to elucidate where you are in this point,
right?
Or do you want to read it? You wrote it.
Sure, I'll read it.
Yeah.
What is it?
Page 147, the first full graph.
I would. All right. I would be honored if you.
No, okay. I don't mind reading.
All right, you read it.
I'm a stage whore.
Yes. Let me sit back and listen to my
this
book.
This is the writing. And then I'll read several Penthouse Forum letters.
Dana Gould, famous comedian, read my book to me.
At the bottom of every lake is a Lovecraftian hellscape. If you ever go snorkeling in your father-in-law's lake in Maine, you will see for yourself that it is all ooze and muck and fallen trees and sunken demonic cities of impossible geometries. That last part is not true, but this is. You will see huge freshwater clams, and you will scream underwater. You will run through the foot-swallowing mud of the shallows and shore and back up to the house and seek confirmation of the madness that has just invaded your eyes. That is so true.
Oh, yay.
there is something at the bottom of those. Maine itself is the most aggressive landscape.
Yeah.
And people who vacation, the beaches are made of rocks.
Yeah.
It's like, where's the one place that you always imagine yourself barefoot?
The beach.
Not Maine, baby.
Yeah, right.
you need boots to go to the
vacation land is the nickname of the state of Maine, and it is a cruel joke to lure people there to their doom.
Yes.
No one who's gone on vacation wants to go to the beach in Maine. And where the oceans are so cold, they're made of hate, they want to kill you.
And the oceans are made of hate.
And every cell in your body, you go in there and every cell in your body screams the first half of the word hypothermia. And as I say in the book, the lakes are no less weird and aggressive in their own way.
There are
these freshwater clams in the bottom of this lake that are the size of Nerf footballs.
Yeah, they're huge. They're huge.
And I'd never.
And they're open and you see them close. And if you put your foot in them, they will close on your foot.
Oh, I've never experienced that.
And there are also not painter turtles, but snapper turtles.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that will nip at you.
Yeah, Maine.
There's a reason Stephen King sprang from that soil.
Yeah, and it's a haunted place, and it has this kind of rugged beauty, a legitimate beauty,
a flinty beauty.
Its harshness is part of its beauty, and it reminds you that nature doesn't care whether you live or die.
You know what it is? It's Lee J. Cobb.
Yeah,
if a state could be a dude,
right?
It would be Lee J. Cobb.
Right.
If Florida could be a person, it would be a dumb whore.
Right. Maine is the kind of place that says, is saying to you, it's not about you.
Yeah.
You don't matter.
I remember
this will last and you will not.
Yeah. I remember this gentleman wasn't from Maine, but this is a very New England attitude. In high school, I was on the High Honor Society, which means nothing.
Sure.
Except I got certain grades because I wasn't out dating people. Yeah. I was home doing homework. And I was an usher at the movie theater, and I had to come in late, as I have to be late tomorrow. I have to go to the Honor Society induction, and my parents are going to be there, so I have to go. And the manager goes, "Don't shit yourself."
Just that's it. Good.
Don't shit yourself.
There's so many interpretations of that line.
My oldest brother came up to me. My oldest brother came to see me perform once and said after the show, "Hey, I don't mean to compliment you, but that was pretty good." I don't mean to compliment you.
I don't mean to do you the shame of praising you. Mm-hmm. And that was, for a long time, Maine was settled as a vacation destination at a time when most people in the United States didn't go on vacation.
Right.
You know, vacation as we understand it now didn't really exist until the post-war economic boom,
yeah,
and the baby boomers,
gave people children,
and they had cars, and they all had cars, and they could go places,
right?
And there were labor protections that gave them 2 weeks of vacation,
right? By the way, by liberals,
yeah, by liberals, all that's done now. Yeah. Remember that minute when we had a middle class?
Yeah,
that's all. Right. It's all gone.
But if a working
middle class.
If you're a staunch right-wing conservative that enjoys the weekend, thank a liberal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But because before that, you were either working on your farm, you couldn't go take a vacation, or you were in the city too busy dying in a shirtwaist factory fire or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
So vacation was invented in Maine much earlier by wealthy Bostonians and New Yorkers who could afford to take 2 or 3 or 5 weeks to go to a place that was better for their gout or something.
Yeah. And Maine, even in the summer, even in like August, the water's freezing. You're born and raised here in Illinois.
Yeah, I've lived pretty much in the Chicago area all my life.
You were in Brockett. Did you ever go to Second City? Did you ever study all that? Because you have all of that talent.
I went to shows, but I honest to God did not have the confidence to do that.
That's insane.
It took years and years before I actually had the confidence to think, you know, maybe I can. I am kind of funny. But yeah, I honest to God, and I had friends who were in it.
And all of those people, I'm sure, are fans of yours because they were all watching
you
on television.
And they, you know, my friends would say, you know, we really should bring you in to go. And I was like, well, I don't know. Because I really did not have any confidence.
Neither did they. Voice of insecurity is what puts you in the job that you have.
I guess
Well, I say that. Yeah. You know, like Joe Flaherty, like Count Floyd. It's almost not even a parody.
Sure. Oh, yeah. And I saw him on stage at Second City. And
he's
a
genius.
Joe
Flaherty is a genius. Yeah. That entire group.
That was always one of my favorite TV shows. I think it's both.
Yeah. GRUE.
Ooh.
You're a couple. That would be like a great Vincent Price if he was guest hosting The Tonight Show. Lipton has an interesting cup of groo for Halloween. They'd have to hold up the thing. Johnny would have to hold up a can of Alpo, and we'll be right back. And then, so it's broadcasting, and it is like being in the Army. Like, you're one place for 3 years, and then Jerry Bishop goes, all right, you're in San Diego now. Or what happened with there? How did you end up taking over that gig?
Well, Jerry, we were – when Kaiser Broadcasting came into Chicago –
which owned Channel 56 in Boston.
Yes. One of the bosses told him, don't worry. You're going to be on here. Don't worry about it all. And the next thing they did was get rid of him and replace him with the Ghoul.
Right.
So it was like, and the Ghoul for his teeth, a broadcasting guy? Really?
And the Ghoul was the second generation of Ghoulardi.
Right,
who was Ernie Anderson, who was the voice of the Love Boat.
The Love Boat.
And whose son is director Paul Thomas Anderson.
Right. And the Ghoul came in, and one of the first things
he did. Again, see Avalanche, dot, dot.
And one of the first things he did on one of his shows was make fun of Sven Ghuli and saying he was a no-talent. And that went over pretty poorly.
Yeah.
And the Ghoul did not last, I don't think, 6 months here. Because people just, you know, after seeing Jerry, they didn't want
to. Yeah, we had the Ghoul, too, because that was syndicated because we had Kaiser the Ghoul.
Sure,
56.
Yeah. Jerry and I then ended up working in radio. And I was like his producer sidekick. at the time, they didn't have sidekicks.
Right.
So, but about 85% of the people he would talk to doing shtick on the phone were me.
Again, like these beautiful little side roads. Very Bob and Ray.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
Talking about people that were freakishly ahead of their time.
We'd be riding in early in the morning because it was a morning show, and, you know, getting up at, you know, 4:30. That was a joy. And we'd be riding in, and he'd have me going through the newspaper and pulling out articles and stuff. And he'd look at, okay, today you're going to be Dean Martin. And I was like, okay, I guess. Uh-huh. And sure enough, a while later, oh, yeah, I got Kathy with me. And it was so much fun because it really was kind of flying by the seat of your pants, coming up with stuff just, you know, out of nowhere every single day. Uh-huh. And it was great. But then Jerry ended up moving to – well, I'm getting ahead of myself. Mm-hmm. When he was still here and he was doing public affairs stuff and working at the NBC station – one of his friends at another station said, you know, as a lark for the summer, how would you like to do Sven Gulli just for a short-term thing, just for the summer? And Jerry was like, well, he said, I'm not quite sure. And the reason he gave at the time was because, honestly, he had a real interest in politics, and he thought someday he might run for office. And he didn't want, you know, his opponent going, this man running against me, look, long green hair and rubber chickens. Is this the man you want to elect?
Yeah, but you could certainly not have a guy who was the president that just came off a dumb TV show.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, and Jerry turns to me and says, you know what? You could be Son of Sven Gulli. And, you know, you and I could write it and I'll produce it and you could be the guy. And to me, that was the most flattering thing I could ever hear.
That's sort of like, is it, what's the, help me out. What is the, is it Journey where like one of their fans is now... Journey and also Black Flag. I'm always conflating the two.
So similar.
That is amazing. Journey. Yeah. Just never got around that. Never could get into
I
Journey.
I think you stopped believing.
I did stop believing. I stopped believing right away. I was performing in Sunnyvale, California at this club called Rooster Tea Feathers. Uncle Fucker's Chuckle Hutch. And I was performing with my Tom Kenny, who I've known forever. And Tom was making fun of Journey. And he was obsessed with the song. And it was popular at the time. And this is up in the Bay Area. When the lights go down in the city. And Tom, who like doesn't like any song that was recorded after 1948. He's like, what the fuck is city? And then... guy in the back gets up and walks out. And I go, who's that? And the guy goes, Steve Perry.
No!
Oh, I guess he was not a fan. You work in radio, and then you become the guy that you really dig, which
Well, he brought that up, and we had some false starts on it, and it never really happened. And as we went along, Jerry then ended up getting a job in San Diego, and he was leaving town, and... other guys I had were Dick Orkin, who did the Chicken Man series and does a lot of great commercials. I'd worked with him. He had gone to the West Coast as well. And Jerry said, well, what do you want to do? You know, what are you going to do now? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to sell somebody here on a TV show. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to sell the Son of Sven Gulli thing, you have my permission. Go ahead. And, you know, which, again, he's just like turning the keys over to me. And incredibly generous, and again, you know, him having the faith in me, which I didn't even have at the time, that I'd be able to pull it off.
Yeah.
And I called a bunch of different TV stations, and one of them, the program director, listened to what I had to say, laughed, and hung up on me. But then I went to WFLD, where Jerry's show had originally run, and talked to a guy who was the program director at the time, and he had not been around when Jerry was there. And he's like, you know, we've been thinking of doing something like this. So we should have a bake-off and have a lot of people audition and do whatever they want to do, you know, whatever character they want to do, and we'll see who we want to use. And I said, well, I just came to you with this. I came to him with scripts, fully formed idea. I said, well, I just brought you the whole idea. He said, yeah, but we'll let a lot of people try it.
And so such a beautiful show
after
story.
A while, you know, eventually it did fall.
You know, it'd be a great idea. What if we screwed you?
Yeah. Once again, a boss in broadcasting.
Yeah,
doing
I know.
That?
I know.
That's unheard of.
Yeah. What a great idea.
Eventually, I did end up getting the gig, and it has taken off from there. 1979, I started, and I'm still here.
That's great.
That's such a beautiful story.
Yeah.
It is. And the thing I always like to mention is that, you know, Jerry, when I was sending him material, he could have said, you know, hey, thanks a lot, kid, and just ignored me and just gone on doing what he was doing. But he was a generous enough guy and he had enough appreciation for what I could do that he decided to, you know, be my mentor and to get me into the business.
The famous story, well, in this world, like the Vampira Elvira story.
Sure.
The station came to Myla Nurmi in the early 80s and because Myla created the character Vampira and owned the rights. And they came to her and said, we'd like to do it again. We'll bring you in. You'll be a producer. You'll help us cast it and set it. And she brought in the blueprints of the soundstage and how they did it and the scripts that she had and helped them set everything up. And the whole thing was, I'll license this to you. I'll retain the rights of the character. And they cast it. They cast this woman from the Groundlings named Cassandra Peterson, and they came up with this whole new angle to do it, and everybody was happy. And literally the day they were going to start shooting, they told Myla, oh, you have to sign this so we can shoot. And she was no dummy. She read it, and it was her relinquishing the rights of the character. And she said, no, I'm not going to sign this.
Sure.
And they said, okay, well, then you have to leave. And then they changed the name from the Vampira Show to the Elvira Show. Mm-hmm. The day they started shooting.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And then she just couldn't afford to fight the lawsuit. Sure. It was just one of those things. But it's not Cassandra's fault. Cassandra's just an actress. She's trying to make a living. She's not going to, you know, I don't blame Cassandra. But yeah, they're just like, you know, we came up with a better idea. We're just going to fuck you.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
What if we get our money and your money? That way we have more money. Is that a good idea? You like that? I think that works pretty well.
Yes, that was.
I've
experienced that so many times.
Yeah, no, it is. And they just like, it's just business. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they said in the Godfather.
That's the way the business works. Okay. Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
You have to be dishonest? Okay,
yeah.
Well, he never asked for anything as far as, you know, once I was the character.
And
he just was, and from what I hear, he was very proud of me. And he enjoyed what I did, and he was happy that I succeeded. So.
That's fantastic. And he only recently passed, yeah?
Yeah, just a few years ago. He had been ill, and he passed away. He was still out in San Diego.
Right.
He had a couple of restaurants. He'd been doing radio and TV, but then had some medical problems. And,
oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm glad I had the chance to tell him how much he meant to me, certainly.
Sure.
But I still miss him.
Yeah, I'm like that with Ron Jeremy.
Wait, isn't he still alive?
He's still alive.
if you call that living. He doesn't look unlike Svengoolie, you have to admit.
People have brought that up.
Oh, really?
Yes, honest to God. They, people who didn't know who I was or anything have seen still pictures and hey, isn't that Ron Jeremy? It's like, no.
Yeah. Can you see his head? Yes, then no.
The house in Western Massachusetts is now more or less behind us. The happy story is that my dad, who couldn't bear to go there after my mom died, and that's right. Why my wife and I took
it
over.
Shine a little light on that for the listeners, because that wasn't recorded.
Oh, right. Well, so what happened was my mom passed away in 2000 of lung cancer very quickly and suddenly. That was a moment.
My condolences.
Well, thank you. I mean, it was.
How old a woman was she when she passed?
58.
Very young.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, a lifelong smoker. Don't do it, kids.
Yeah.
And
58.
Yeah. It breaks. It's one of those things that happens to different people, you know, different times in their lives, whether it's the loss of a parent or someone else or whatever it is that kind of breaks your life in half.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it can be – it is a point when you're done. Do you know what I mean? Like you can be undone emotionally for a long time and you can't figure out how to go forward, which was definitely the case with my dad and to obviously to me as well.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also a moment where I was like, oh, yeah, I've been wasting my life. I'm working at this literary agency, not doing what I care about. I'm done with that.
Right.
It's timed it out. Like, I would rather my mom be alive, but her passing taught me a powerful lesson, which is you're not.
Here you are.
Yeah, get done with the stuff that's dumb and get going with the stuff that's not.
Yeah.
Anyway, my dad could not bear to go to the house, their weekend house in Western Massachusetts. As a freelance, I had just become a freelance magazine writer at the time.
And
he appropriately presumed that I would never have an asset in my life.
I was going to say.
And he said, you know, I can't, it's just too hard for me to go there and I don't want to sell the house. And I know your mom would have wanted you to have it. So if you can pay the taxes and the cost of running the house.
Right.
I'll sell it to you for a dollar. Can you do that? And the answer was no. I didn't have that money, but I did have a dollar and I wanted a house. So I lied and said yes. But now we've moved. We bought a house in Maine a couple of years ago because that's always been my wife's dream. And it's part of my job to fulfill dreams for my wife.
Sure.
And
that's part of the gift of the great gift of children and marriage is the settling of the understanding that it is not about you anymore.
Right, exactly.
And to me, and I'm not being funny when I say that.
No, I definitely do not find it funny.
Such a relief.
Yeah.
Well, my youngest is 8, but I'm so excited to have smaller children in my life again.
Yeah.
Because it's like I get an extension of that. Like even when my – because – I have really good friends. Many of my good friends, you know, you go through these phases of your life. You meet your mate at the same time. You have that period of your life where you're going to a wedding every weekend.
Yeah.
Because your friends are all getting married at the same time. And then about 2 years later, everybody's
growing up in Brookline,
babies.
I first had a wave of bar mitzvahs.
Bar mitzvahs, right.
And then weddings.
Weddings. And then it's, then everybody's having babies.
Right.
All your friends disappear for 2 years because they're raising their babies.
Right.
Then you don't. Everybody gets divorced at the same time.
Well, I was going to say, then there aren't a series of ceremonies, but you start getting trickling in news of divorce from all over the country.
The divorces happen at the same time. And I have a lot of friends who are now, their kids are going to college.
Right.
Their kids are old and they're empty nesters.
Right.
And that's hard.
Yeah.
It's really hard.
It's another, I'm done. Like,
you spend so much time being mom and dad.
Right.
And then when you're not mom and dad all the time,
yeah.
Then you look at each other and it's like, who are you again?
Yeah,
because you haven't been.
Well,
in those
you go
roles.
Through these.
You have to work. You have to. You have to work on being.
You don't know who you are anymore.
Yeah, and you have to work, and you don't know who your mate is, and you really a marriage, a relationship, and this is something I'm learning from my mistakes.
Right.
You know, you can never take it for granted and go like, well, this is fine. We're married, so this is fine. Let's just deal with the kids. Like, no, you have to. Date night, and you've got to put all your other shit away,
right.
and it cultivate.
But
that
even if you do that work, you're still going to face a hard transition. For example,
absolutely
when your kids go away,
yeah.
Or when they stop, or when they push away from you in the way my dad was afraid of.
Yeah, I'm getting. Yeah. I have that now with my oldest. But as I said, I now have an extension.
Right. But you know there are these horribly traumatic transitions, right? When you lose a parent.
By the way, the image of this episode is just going to be Statler and Waldorf.
Perfect. You know, those guys found an emotionally healthy way to live out the twilight years.
Yeah. You know,
they loved each other. They had companionship.
It's Mel and Carl Reiner, and even if Mel had a mustache, they would look exactly like each other.
But you know, if we go through these traumas, big and small, losing people, our lives being turned upside down by tragedy, or smaller things just like kids not hugging us anymore, or you know, they're hard, right? And they are those moments where you don't know who you are anymore. What do I do next?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there's nothing to do. You know, where you feel even that depressed, right? But if we're lucky, you know, and so I find that. These transitions are akin to swimming in Maine.
Mm-hmm.
That water does not want you in it. It's going to fight you every step of the way. Your body is rejecting it.
Yeah.
When you go into the water in Maine, your body's like,
what are you doing?
Yeah. You remember we have free will, right?
Yeah.
None of this is important.
Yeah.
But sometimes confronting the new on the other side of whatever that break is in your life.
Uh-huh.
Is just a period of your whole body screaming, you know,
yeah.
And feeling like this is intolerable. This will never get better. I cannot go on with this.
Well,
the water, your body gets used to it.
Yes.
And there is a kind of euphoria to swimming in Maine once your body gets used to it, because not only is swimming fun, I've discovered later in life, now that I feel more comfortable taking my shirt off, because who cares?
Right.
It's not about me.
Yeah.
But also that you've endured something
yes.
to get to that other side.
Absolutely.
And then the other bonus of it is you can't stay in the water very long because you will get hypothermia. So you're out in 30 minutes and you've done your exercise.
You've done your exercise.
Right.
You feel
physical and emotional.
Yes. Yeah. You feel like you've accomplished something.
Right.
Yeah. And I get that even when you get into any cold water. It's like, I can't go to the beach and not go in the water unless it's freakishly cold.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I've
I've turned down a challenge.
And I, people who read the book, this is what I want to say to you. I do not want to create a cult of polar bear swimmers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Don't go swimming in Maine and die and then have your families blame me. I'm talking Maine as a metaphor
in
this case. Do you understand swimming, what I'm saying, everybody?
Swimming is a metaphor.
I don't want you coming to Maine. I don't need to see you up there. Yeah. Stay away. Yeah. That's the one part of me that is now native Maine.
Right.
Yes.
Well, swimming.
Come spend your money, but stay the hell away from me.
Well, again, I was going to say it's like it's a metaphor. The whole endeavor is a metaphor, as is I liken it to Hugh Hefner's penis.
Oh my God!
When the Viagra hits, the first thought is why?
Yeah. Right.
Why? And then 10, 15 minutes later, okay.
I don't think that I don't think that and on some level hope.
The original title of this book was Hugh Hefner's Penis.
With Hugh Hefner's Penis. I don't believe that, and I, on some level, hope that he was not happy when he died. For two reasons. One, he was a guy who avoided the transition in his life.
Absolutely.
And that's hard work, to maintain that delusion about yourself. And I don't think that it's emotionally...
Oh, he's an utter. I was making a joke. He's the definition of a failure.
Yeah.
No, he is. It's like you missed the entire point. The lack of an ability to effectively move into the different seasons of your life, as you're talking about.
That's sort of
your job.
That's one of the consolations of middle age is that deep soul feeling like, oh, it's not about me.
Yeah.
Like the universe is not about me at all.
Yeah.
At all. And that can move you to do things for other people, or at least move you to not care so much about how people think about you.
Yeah.
You know?
My friend Matt Weinhold said it really well. He goes, it used to be that all I wanted was sex and dinner, and I was fine. And now I'm like, dinner's nice.
Dinner is really nice. I do like dinner.
Vacationland, available on Amazon or in bookstores.
Barnes & Noble, too.
I hear that there is a physical store you go in, and there are books in there.
It's called Bricks & Mortar, the store.
Bricks & Mortar.
Go to your local independent bookstore or to your reputable online seller. Give them some money and some of your information, and you will get this book in return.
You told us yesterday that you have the original wig. The wig is still from the same...
The wig I have, at the time when I was auditioning and doing this stuff...
At the time when you were auditioning for the role you created.
Yes, exactly. And the first thing that happened was I looked exactly like Jerry's character when I did the first audition.
Right.
And they were like, well, the hippie thing is kind of wearing out now, because it was 1978 at the time. And they said, well, maybe you should do something different. So at first, I just changed the color of the hair, which did not go over well, because hey, you look like a guy who'd be stealing our car in Lower Wacker Drive.
Right.
And I had to get a long brown wig. And
what was the origin of the look? Were you just hacking around with different ideas?
Yeah, exactly. And I thought, well, okay, theatrical wigs, way too expensive for me at the time, because I was just, you know, barely getting around.
Right.
And I went to Kmart. And, you know, they used to sell ladies' wigs there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go up to the young lady there, and I explained to her, and this was a great – I'm like, you know, I'm going to be doing a TV show. And I need a long brown wig. And, you know, I thought something here. She goes, yeah, we have a lot of gay guys who come in asking for these. Not that there's anything wrong with it.
Sure.
But
and Ed Wood was behind you going, I'm going to be directing a movie. I need a woman's Angora sweater.
That's the other aisle over there.
Yeah.
But so I get the wig and I'm telling her, okay, the thing is, you know, you'll see that I'm doing this TV show. It's going to be on starting in May on this date. Make sure that you tune in. You'll see the wig. Then she's like, okay. Naturally, they delayed the start of the show until June.
Yeah, yeah.
So sometime in May, she's going like, yeah, okay, sure, whatever.
That's sad, man. Just couldn't accept who he was.
But it is.
It's the same wig.
The same wig. It has served me well. We're working on getting a new one.
You're bigger now than you've ever been. You're now because of MeTV.
Sure.
The show's national.
Mm-hmm.
I was so delighted when I discovered it.
Well, that's nice. Thanks.
And it is one of the only shows I watch, although I will say, because I watch MeTV a lot, and it's like, you know, the advertising on the show, there's a lot of like reverse mortgage, walk-in bathtubs.
Don't forget the catheters.
Yeah.
My oldest daughter, who's always says, "Dad, you watch this channel, and it's the commercials are just for people getting ready to die."
One of our favorites. What's the matter, Grandma? It's my knees.
It's my knees. Yeah.
With the worst animation possible. Clip art.
Yes.
We found that. And it's like, what? You know, they made three frames with three mouths and just keep shifting those.
I don't understand that.
And then at the end, the character doesn't even resemble the original one. She's on the skateboard going down the street, and what? It's a different woman. That's really.
Yeah, I know. But
they're wonderful sponsors.
Yeah, they're delightful. Tell me a little bit about how the MeTV thing happened and how the show has changed in that time, because it's – is there anybody else in the country doing this?
Not nationally people, over the air, I don't
Yeah, people
think
do it so. On the online.
Yeah, there's a lot of them online. There's a few that have real limited distribution to maybe a few cities.
Uh-huh.
But I'm the only one on a broadcast network, far as I know. And it changed a lot because I'd done the show from 79 to 86 and then was fired for the first time when Fox took over.
Right.
And they said,
fortunately, and that didn't take off.
This show is not really the kind of thing a network should have, but the late night Joan Rivers show was. So.
Right, yeah.
And so I was freelancing doing stuff. And during that time period, I was still doing appearances and, you know, showing up in as guest shots as Svengoolie, or son of Svengoolie as it was at the time. Then on the 10th anniversary of when I was fired actually, it was the 10th anniversary of me being hired. One of the local columnists who was a big fan of mine, Rob Feeder, wrote an article saying, "It's a shame this still isn't on." And the Fox people started to panic, like, "Oh, this is giving us a bad reputation." So they called me in and they said, "Well, we've got an idea. You'll be like a guy who's down in the cellar of the station. You'll be the Fox Phantom and you're showing old, you know, horror movies and stuff." And I said, "Well, that's great, except right now, on, I think it was the Country Music Channel or whatever, there's a guy doing that, you know, the Phantom of the Opry. It's the exact same thing. We should do something different." And recently before that, somebody had actually pirate broadcasted and broken into the signal of a couple TV stations wearing a Max Headroom mask and, you know, breaking into the air. He paddled somebody's rear end. It was just for a few minutes, but it was very notorious.
That's all it takes sometimes.
Well, yeah, you know, that today that would be on HBO.
Yeah.
I said, "Here's what I think we should do. I should be a disgruntled former employee." Art imitates life.
Yeah. Write what you know.
And I said, "It'll be like I'm breaking into the station for 2 hours every week and showing a movie." And they were like, "Well, okay." So we had like promos for things like Donahue. The promo would start out with the normal footage. Then there'd be static, and it would show me then, you know, messing around with some weird broadcast equipment, and a sign in the background said Friday at 10:30. Then it would fade out, and it would be the end of the regular promo. So they started running these, and people were like, "What is this? This guy's breaking into the air?" It got so bad that the FCC called the chief engineer of the station and said, "Hey, you want us to send out a truck to find out who's doing this?" And he had to admit to them that it was a publicity stunt, which they did not appreciate.
No, they don't appreciate that.
But we start on Friday nights, and we called it the Co-Zone. Uh-huh. And I would break into the movies and do that. And eventually it turned into me hosting Stooges on there. And then I was fired for the second time, even though along the way they had made me the weekend weather anchor. Now, I have an interest in weather, but I don't know anything about this stuff. And I said to him, the boss, I said, "You know, what about credibility?" He's like, "Yeah, it's a weatherman. You don't have any credibility." And he said, "You know, in a lot of other cities, the weatherman is also the guy who does the kids show." And I said, "Yeah, like maybe Boise? But, you know,
right.
This is – no offense.
Let's not.
I'm sorry.
Our weatherman is great and does also a great kids show."
And it's Chicago.
It's Boise.
Oh, sorry. It's like Ricky Ricardo there.
Yes, it's
Lucy, where's Boise?
Oh, Lucy.
And so they fired me that second time. And not too long after that, my current boss, Neil Saban, hired me to go on WCIU. It had been all Univision, and Univision wanted to buy the station, and the owners decided they didn't want to sell it to him. And Neil convinced them to make it like an old, regular, independent station. And the first person he hired was me.
That's great.
And we bonded immediately about all the old TV show and the Stooges. He loves the Stooges. And I was on WCIU with the show for several years. And when he started MeTV with the memorable entertainment television and was going to turn into
Is that his?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
He said, "You know, let's put the show on here." So that was 6 years ago, I believe. We did have to make changes because when we were doing just the local show, obviously I was doing the local jokes. I was making fun of local car dealers and local politicians and personalities.
But certain stuff, like nobody, I don't know what Berwyn means.
Sure.
But I still enjoy it.
Well, yeah, basically it's a local small town that at one time when Jerry was doing his show, he had adopted that, was mainly known for used car lots and savings and loans. And every year they have a parade in honor of mushrooms in the fall.
What?
The Hobie Parade, exactly. And he said this would be it. Because at the time, you know, Ron and Martin were doing the Burbank jokes. And also when he was in Cleveland before he came back to Chicago, Goulardi would make fun of Parma.
Right. Okay.
And it was the same sort of thing.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah, I had no idea what it meant. As I said, when I posted, like a lot of people just say, Berwyn. I'm like, okay, whatever.
Yeah, but that was the one main holdover that we've kept for it because it turned out, actually, there's a lot of little Berwyn cities all over the country.
And
so people have gotten the idea of it.
Right. Well, there's always those things like 10,000 holes in Blackburn, Lancashire. Like, you don't need to really know about Blackburn, Lancashire to
exactly.
get from there.
Yeah. And we always used to say, you know, Dave Letterman used to make so many jokes about New York.
Right.
And, you know, the rest of the country wasn't in New York, but they still got them. So it seems like it worked.
And your fandom, has it increased with – because you're always out there as Fenghouli. You're going to conventions now and
– Yeah, we were just talking earlier about the fact that there's a lot of conventions all over the country now that are asking me to come out to them. And we have to figure out how we do that.
Right.
Again, I have one wig and one hat, and I don't want to lose those on the plane.
Right.
And also, usually,
I think you can invest it. I would venture capital you.
Oh, thank you so much. Well, we're just trying to figure out all the logistics of how to do it and finding time in the schedule.
Because that's the problem.
We have a very small crew, as you've seen on our show.
Yes.
You know, four people.
I could fight them.
You could. And you'd win.
I don't know about that.
I loved seeing on set behind you all the little things people sent you, all the little, like, amazing things people make for you.
We're running out of storage room because the viewers are so nice to always make all these little things and send them to us.
That's
and some of them are not little. We have, like, a huge thing that was carved from a tree trunk that's a bust of Svengoolie. That must weigh, you know, about 150 pounds.
Yeah.
And we get so many nice things from people, and it's like we don't know where to put them anymore.
It's one of those things where I like the show in the same reason I like The Twilight Zone, the same reason I love The Simpsons, and the same reason it's like this show knows who I am.
You know?
And it knows that I'm not an idiot and that you don't have to be dumb. You can be smart and love dumb jokes. And, you know, and that you'll talk about Craig Stevens and William Hopper. And it's just like Joel Hodgson used to say about Mystery Science Theater about certain jokes. Like on Mystery Science Theater, many of the references would be from my stand-up act. They were like, they would have jokes about my act. And I was like, no one's going to get this. And he would say, not everybody will get it, but the right people will get it. And that's the story that's why I love the show. So as we go, because we all have other gigs to get to, tell the action figure story.
Oh, yeah. Well, for a long time, we talked about what kind of merchandising to do and finally decided that they'd make an action figure of Svengoolie. And it took a long time to do just because this is such a complicated thing. They make them overseas. And then they have to load them on a big transport boat, and they are not allowed to send the boat over until it's completely full. And it's not just with action figures, but all sorts of things. Full.
Those little tables that you get on a pizza.
Exactly. And those little fidget spinners.
They'll be around forever.
We waited a long time. We were waiting for them to come in, and finally – my ship came in, shall we say. And we took him, and it was great. So we said, okay, we're going to premiere it. We'll first just put something online about it. Nothing on TV about it. In the first 24 hours with just online promotion, half the stock was gone. They made 1,000 because that was the typical run they would make of a figure for the first time. In 24 hours, 500 of them were gone.
Yep.
And within a week, they were all gone. So it's like, wow. And a friend of ours who knows how these kind of things work said that is actually an unprecedented thing. Even like, you know, they make figures of DC characters and all these things. He said nothing has sold out like in a week. So and I keep thinking and there was even something on the packaging. You know, the people are sitting there with needles sticking it in. Make one more Berwyn joke, jerk. You know.
Other podcasts reach for the sky. Dana Goldberg.
We barely try.
This has been the Dana Gould Hour, brought to you by the Internet. Music by Andy Paley, with Jake Posner behind the board. Produced by Jeff Fox. Graphic design and web production by Spencer Hunt and Segan Friend. Sound editing and post-production by Jalinda Palmer and Joe Napolitano. Hey, if you like the show, why don't you drop us a line at show@danagould.com. Tom Kenny speaking.
I'm a DJ, I'm a DJ, I'm a person, I'm a person, I'm a singer. I'm a singer, I love to sing, and DJ, boom, peace out, you are.